The world is changing, and every counterterrorism professional I speak to in the federal government and overseas feels like we are at the doorstep of another 9/11, maybe not something that catastrophic in terms of the visual or the numbers, but that we can see it building, and we don't quite know how to stop it.
Welcome to The Last American Vagabond. I have a special show lined up for you today. Joining me today is Whitney Webb, always somebody excited to talk to, has a couple of really solid articles that just came out, as always, and it's very timed. It's perfectly timed in with all the discussions that we're having and this interesting crossover that we keep discussing, that Whitney and I have discussed in the past, of this kind of war on domestic terrorism, war against the people, and a kind of an interesting crossover both into COVID-19 and the biosecurity state and how that then leads into transhumanism, the Great Reset, technocracy, all the things that we're discussing. And it's a very alarming crossover. And it seems to be, personally, to be one and the same. Now, Whitney's here to discuss the two articles she wrote on these topics. And today we're going to start off with the fact that, guess what? You're likely now a terrorist in the United States if you disagree with the government. How are you today, Whitney?
Hey, I'm doing all right. How are you?
Good, all things considered. Let me actually adjust.
The exact same thing.
But, you know, as always, all things considered, you know, it's like what's funny is it's an interesting time where it's a very, very alarming, dangerous, uncertain time. But it's interesting how clumsy what their actions are. And it seems to be waking up more people than I think I've ever seen. You know, so it's like it's kind of a bittersweet moment where if we can capitalize on how many people are coming around to it all, maybe we could see something actually shift in a really positive direction. You know, so it's kind of like weighing both those things. You know, how about you?
Yeah, well, I think that's why in the U.S. we saw this pivot to the war on domestic terror, because obviously, you know, COVID fear porn and all of this stuff is fading in the U.S. So there's a lot more resistance, I think, to COVID policies in the U.S. and a lot of other Western countries, yeah. In terms of, you know, a percent of the population. So, you know, I think that's why we've seen that pivot once again pop up. You know, it happened with the election last year. Now it most recently got drummed up again with the release of this new domestic terror strategy, which, of course, was announced by Attorney General Merrick Garland, who gave a whole speech saying it was about white supremacists. But if you actually read the strategy, or if you don't want to read the strategy, you can just read my article, which quotes the strategy. You will see that it's a lot more than just that, because, you know, they frame it at the beginning about being about white supremacists, but then they say right after, on equal footing with white supremacists, and we define anti-government and anti-authority extremists as terrorists. And so if you get deeper into the strategy where they detail, they say what those extremists are, you know, they define them, it's pretty clear that it's really anyone the government doesn't like and who presents a threat to the status quo as it is now, but also where they want to take the United States in the coming years, including the implementation of things like stakeholder capitalism, fourth industrial revolution, the automation of factory jobs and all of this. You know, it's not hard to see where this is going. So,
yeah. And you document in there how it's this, the crossover is very interesting, especially with the foreign aspect. That's something that you've really touched a lot on that nobody seems to really dig into, in particular with the Israeli government, but a lot of other foreign entities. And yet this is a domestic problem, right? That's one of the first things that kind of just took me aback when I was reading your article is it's, you know, this is the interesting time where the people who are in agreement with what the government is saying they're trying to accomplish seemingly don't care about the facts around what's actually happening. They just take the narrative, right? So how is it these people, in your opinion, are okay with them saying we have a domestic issue with terrorism, but we're going to work with foreign countries?
Yeah.
The same people that are concerned about a foreign country influencing our policy. Like
I know. Well, they try and get around it by saying, well, actually white supremacy is a global problem and white supremacists sometimes travel to other countries to train and all of this stuff. Not, you know, talking about people that, you know, might go to Ukraine to train with Azov Battalion or something like that.
Right,
you know what I mean?
Right. That's always one that blows my mind. The fact that we can, that the government can openly support a neo-fascist, you know, a neo-Nazi government. And that's a very clear concept. And that doesn't seem to be a contradictory
thing.
You know, it's interesting.
But in terms of foreign partnerships, yeah, I think Israel's government is definitely involved, but I think Five Eyes will be involved as well, which is going to be, you know, most of the English speaking world. And I really think, you know, if you look at history, what they're trying to set up, if we allow them to set it up and allow them to take it that far, is basically an Operation Condor, but set up for the West. And if people don't know what Operation Condor was, that was basically a domestic dissident elimination program that was developed and supported by the CIA in South America with a lot of the U.S.-backed and U.S.-installed military dictatorships there. And basically, it was coordination between multiple countries so that people couldn't escape, for example, from the Pinochet dictatorship in Chile into Argentina, because they were coordinating through Operation Condor with the military junta in Argentina and things like that. So it's basically, you know, they're sort of framing it as something like that, which is really disconcerting. So I think history is really important here because these types of campaigns, when they happen in other countries, have involved the CIA, going back to the 60s with the Phoenix program in Vietnam, and then Operation Condor in South America, and then, you know, some of the things that happened in Central America during that period as well. This was, you know, all had the hands of the CIA, and a lot of the people that were involved in that directly are the people that planned the pivot to homeland security in the years leading up to 9/11.
Right.
And that's why, for example, several months before 9/11, I think it was March or May 2001, you had legislation introduced to create what would become the Department of Homeland Security. They originally were going to call it the National Homeland Security Agency when it was introduced earlier. And then, of course, not 9/11 manufacturers consent for that to be pushed through. But I would argue that DHS was always set up for a war on domestic terror. And something, you know, we pointed out last year is the fact that for the first time ever, the worldwide threat assessment of the CIA was not published. But DHS, even though it's been around 20 years, chooses last year to publish its first domestic threat assessment. I mean, that's an obvious huge pivot of the national security community.
And we've seen a lot of these come up over the years, right? The Pentagon came out with that, or it was supposed to be like it wasn't supposed to be released. And I wondered whether that was the case or not, but it was that weird, like, Battlefield America thing they did where it was like the war is coming home. Remember that? That was years ago, too.
Yeah, years in the making. I really want to stress that. And this isn't just Biden either. You know, a lot of the frame, the foundation for this, as I note in the article, was actually developed by the Department of Justice under Trump and Bill Barr.
That's important for the two-party illusion kind of mentality here, is this is a consecutive thing that continues. And that speaks to the pre-crime that you talk about as well. And, you know, the whole dissidence thing in South America is really alarming. And the idea that, you know, a lot of those people just disappeared from the planet. You know, it's like, that's what we're talking about. And the dissidents are now Americans. And that's why, and it's people like us, which is what you're outlining, is people that just simply have a justifiable concern about what they're trying to do, and they're framing themselves as always altruistic, and if you disagree, then you're a problem. The continuity of government part of that is what that ties back to for me, that you've discussed a lot, the Reagan concept, and that's the dissident list, right? So for people that may not know, you know, if you want to just touch on that for a minute to understand that that's something that's real today, and that people like us are likely on that list, and that would be the list that probably be pulled if something like this were to happen.
Yeah, sure. So that goes back to Iran-Contra. It was part of the Iran-Contra scandal, that particular group, which include people who weren't government at the time, but would be later, like Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld, basically developed continuity for government protocols that would keep the federal government functioning in the event of a national emergency that they kept very vague. But one of the examples of a national emergency included widespread nonviolent opposition to the Reagan administration pushing through a military intervention in Central America. I think specifically it was Nicaragua or something to that effect, or maybe El Salvador. I can't quite remember. But basically, what they had done is also drawn up basically an enemies list that really would put like Nixon's enemy list to complete shame. You could be on there for the most trivial reason. You forgot to pay your taxes one year. You attended a protest. you know, just really minor stuff like that. And you were added to this database of people that were deemed to be unfriendlies that, you know, right. could challenge a particular policy. And basically under continuity of government protocols, they suspend the Constitution, declare martial law, and thus are able to either increase surveillance of a particular person on this list or detain them indefinitely. And of course, we have, thanks to the Obama administration, the NDAA that allowed that to happen to American citizens, indefinite detention without trial. So pretty much every administration since Reagan has advanced this to various degrees.
Exactly. Go ahead. Let your
Well, yeah, so that database is called Maine Corps, and it still exists today. No one's really written about it since like 2008. It was Tim Shorrock and Chris Ketchum that I think were the last journalists to write about it. And at that point, they said there were about like 7 to 8 million people on it. We can assume it's more now. And we also know that when 9/11 happened and the days after 9/11, some aspects of continuity of government were activated, and the Maine Corps database was seen in use at the White House. And it's believed that that particular database was used to flag different people after 9/11 and the war on terror for increased surveillance, among other things. So.
And as you pointed out, I want to reiterate that, this is not an opinion. Since the war on terror, the 9/11, you know, the Patriot Act and the direction, the beginning of the implementation of the security state in that sense, every part of those actions has been turned towards Americans, as you pointed out. Like, yes, they argue they're out here doing things in foreign policy, but it's aimed at us, surveillance of Americans, you know, under the guise that's what they're doing, right? So it's not hard to realize the domestic part of this is, it's, you know, it's what it always has been. Did I like the point you made there? It's just simply naming it what it's always been. It's aimed at us, right?
Yeah, and Maine Corps today has all the fruits of the surveillance, that's been going on over the past several decades. All this... surveillance of your financial transactions, what you do on social media, all of this stuff, really social media. And as I wrote about, you know, about Facebook, it has, you know, ties to the U.S. military going back to its origins, and Peter Thiel, that was basically part of expanding this with his creation of Palantir, which is also a key part, I would argue, of, you know, how Maine Corps, you know, works today. You know, social media was set up as a way to just have you basically profile yourself for the government. And then also they wanted to use it to try and humanize artificial intelligence at the same time. You know, but it was definitely a way to basically get you to profile yourself. And that's why so much of this, the new war on domestic terror, relies basically on pre-crime that's drawn from what people post on social media. So I think one of the best ways we can get around this is for regular people to boycott Twitter and Facebook. Stop using it. Use something else. If you're going to follow people, you still want to follow people on Twitter, you know, make an account that you can make a newsfeed for, but don't like anything. Don't retweet anything. Just don't feed the beast, you know, because people are still doing it to a big degree. And like, obviously you and I are on there because we're trying to get info out, but people that know what's going on and are worried like, oh man, am I being profiled by the government? They're using the stuff against you. So just delete your accounts. It's the best thing to do. I put my face out there. So do you, Ryan. So like, you know, we're in a different category, I guess, but you know, I mean, you can definitely delete your stuff.
I wholeheartedly agree with you, but I would just add that, like, to your point, exactly. And same kind of thing as trying to get on YouTube still to get people to see it. Mm-hmm. It's just about, like, you know, like you're saying, I'm not on there posting shots of me eating food with my forks, you know, like, hey, I'm over here checking in, you know, we're simply sharing data and information. And yeah, to a degree that does continue to profile, but I argued the biggest point is just don't engage in a personal level with these platforms. That's what they're thirsty for, right? They want to know why you think things, why you do things, when you do them, your thought process, you know, that speaks to the idea you brought up before about the, you know, machine learning and why in a way that effort failed for them because it kind of just grabbed everything and it kind of didn't work the proper way. And that's why I had this weird, very alarming concern about what's happening with the injections right now and why that could be like a setup for, you know, a real world trial of some sort of, you know, idea that the meshing I talked about before. But, you know, to get back to the point, I think that this is all about the pre-crime aspect. Right. I mean, really, that, you know, but being able to say you're going to do these things, which, as you say in the article, and this is what the secondary point I think was the most important, is that it all builds towards making a case that your words, your discussions, right, your misinformation, your conspiracy theories
wrong are think.
Violent. Well, yes, wrong think, but then therefore violence or can lead to terrorism, therefore you're a terrorist. And this is the hate speech dynamic. This is alarming thinking, right? So can you touch on that and how you
Also, if you read my article on the strategy, you'll see that it's also a push towards increasing censorship of people like you and me saying that, you know, our content leads to violence, despite, you know, there being no evidence to support that. And basically saying like, you know, disinformation campaigns by Russia, which, of course, we all know all about that since 2016 and what that was really about, you know, basically saying that that, you know, could be targeted within this new framework that they've set up. So
it's all subjective is the point, right? They can just allege that, you know, you're working with Russia or these words led to this person's actions of violence. Therefore you're, you know, it's just subjective. And that's how all of it's been since Patriot Act. And even before they can bend the words to suit what they want, you know?
Yeah. And a platform they'll definitely start to target as this heats up is going to be Telegram, because they've already said that Telegram allows these people to communicate and all of that. A lot of people have gotten off of Facebook and Twitter or set up alternative, you know, their channels and stuff to get info out on Telegram. I've definitely done that. But, you know, I think for, you know, content creators, it's really going to be a matter of platform hopping as this goes on, because we really can't trust that. So, you know, I know that's a pain for, you know, people that watch our stuff or read our stuff. But, you know, it's not like we're making the rules, you know, we're just trying to keep it online for you. So, you know,
as James Evan Pilato put it the other day, we're bobbing and weaving, right? We're just like jumping around, trying to get the punches in when we can, you know?
You know, it is like that to a degree, but I think we also need to remind our audiences that they're going to have to do that to an extent as well, to find our stuff and make sure they stay up to date. I think one of the best ways, honestly, is mailing lists and bookmarking people's homepages. Because at some point maybe they'll come for, you know, your domain or my domain, like they did to Press TV recently, or something like that. You know, it remains to be seen. But you know, it's complicated for sure.
One other thing I wanted to ask you about on this is you could touch on in general, and this is sort of a similar topic to what we just touched on, but it has interesting ties back to January 6th, to the Trump administration itself, and the idea of, you know, incitement to violence, and the idea that just any anti-government sentiment, and you even make an interesting note about how they make a clear distinction of you simply, you know, they say violently opposed to, but one, that's something that is protected by the Constitution, which whether you agree with or not, you know, but that same point that just having an anti-government sentiment, have, you know, anti-capitalist, anti-World Economic Forum is therefore somehow.
Violently opposing something doesn't mean violence, right? But that's how they define some of these anti-government and anti-authority extremists, saying they violently oppose these things. Okay. So as you point out, that is protected in the Constitution. That's a free speech thing, right? Because if you violently oppose something, you can just be vocal about it. It doesn't mean you're necessarily going to be violent, but you have to keep in mind with the pre-crime aspect of this, a phrase they use a lot and a phrase Bill Barr used a lot was people mobilizing toward violence.
Right.
So you just have to show that perhaps there will be future intent at some point that you will become violent.
The Bethlehem doctrine of the independent media, right? So it's like they're about to do something. And then it even goes one step further back that our content led to these people then mobilizing violence, right? That's the conspiracy theory crossover. It's the same concept, right? It's just this blank statement.
Yeah. And they also leave the door kind of open to make, you know, protests, define protests as violent, whether or not they are. And of course, we know that they send in provocateurs and things like that, regardless of what type of protest movement it is, and regardless of what end of the political spectrum it is. And actually, people on the right have been feeding into this the whole time, like with what happened last summer, saying that, you know, these people need to be on the left need to be declared terrorist groups. And now people on the left are saying, well, you know, people on the right that were at January 6th, including like the grandmas and stuff, need to be declared terrorists and all of this stuff. I mean, and it's obviously
ridiculous.
The polarization of the Trump era, I think, was really necessary for this agenda to move forward.
Exactly.
So I think, you know, in retrospect, that's a pretty significant point to consider.
I have come around to be pretty, and again, it's my opinion, but throughout the whole administration, I was kind of waffling, like, do I think he's part of this? Do I think he's just kind of being a useful tool for them and not knowing it? I'm pretty certain at this point that this was chosen to happen, right? As I pointed out many times, this entire thing would have been different if somebody else would have been there. All of the people that would have been the most resistant to all of this wouldn't have been placated by thinking Trump was on their side. Right. I mean, it's an obvious thing to point out, even if that was an accidental coincidence. The, yeah. people, the Patriots, the militias, they all would have been like, this is clearly an unconstitutional act. You know, it's just interesting. And that led to where we are now.
Well, you know, if it wasn't for Trump, the left would not be the new neocons. And that's basically what they become because of Russiagate. You know, their heroes right. are people like John Brennan and Bill Kristol and stuff like this. I mean, God. It's nuts how that happened. And it's no surprise that a lot of people are, you know, cheering on. A war on domestic terror when it's clearly, you know, basically like a tribalist thing, like, oh, they're the bad guys on that yeah. side and they all have to go to jail and, you know, they're terrorists and whatever. I mean, it's insane.
It's such an inherent happened. Thing for humans, though, right? Mm-hmm. This tribalist mind, that's what we are. We have a very tribalist mindset and they abuse that, right? They know that they can pit us against each other and make us into little groups that attack, you know, realizing that really the difference is between us and them, the government and the people, mm-hmm. you know, but that they abuse that stuff. It's not
a government extremist, Ryan. Be careful.
Right, exactly. Oh, look, man. I mean, I openly espouse anti-government sentiment.
I mean,
all
we
the time.
Both do. I'm yeah, just joking.
Governments are right now, governments are the problem. I'm not going to shy away from saying that. I have a right mm-hmm. to say that, right? The problem is that they're trying to make that out to be something that leads to direct violence. And even if that's therefore someone takes that idea and does it, it's still not me. Making violence happen. I'm actively saying I mean, you know, I don't need to say it all the time, but I repeat it all the time that I am never advocating for violence. I don't agree with that. I think violence begets violence, but I can still point out that they are the problem. We need to find another way forward, right? But see that they don't, the nuance there doesn't matter.
They don't want nuance. They don't exactly. want nuance at exactly. all. Yeah. Yeah. I couldn't agree more with that. It's just a really unfortunate situation, but I think, you know, if you actually look at the end of the strategy or alternatively the end of my article, right. you'll see that the main motive of this is to restore faith in government in the yes. U.S. government faith. By either, taking out, however you want to interpret that, people that will never like the government. And then also, as it says in the strategy, launching basically a massive propaganda campaign made by DHS, you know, to enhance faith of government among, you know, people that aren't terrorists or whatever. I mean, this is an insane recipe for, I mean, this is a dictatorship that they're trying to set up and it should be pretty obvious.
I think it is
to everyone with a brain. Yeah.
At the very least. Mm-hmm. But the word faith, like I can't even believe this has been so commonly discussed in the last, so this is since COVID, right? Faith in government. Like those shouldn't even be in the same sentence. And we would have said this before COVID-19, at least to
yes.
a degree.
Yes. But if you watched World Economic Forum Agenda Week like I did, not that I would expect everyone
yeah.
to do that.
No, but, thank you.
Know, you. I work in the space, so I you know, I watch this crap so you don't have to.
Right, right.
Basically, but Klaus Schwab gave a really important prophetic, perhaps you could say, speech of what to expect this year. One of the things he said is that COVID-19 will fade into climate change. We've been seeing indications oh, yep. of that all year long. This yep. was back in January. Okay.
Climate lockdowns coming your way. We've been reporting that long before Tucker talked about it, right?
Right. But the other thing he said is this is the year that we restore trust in our institutions, i.e., you know, the institutions that make up the public-private partnerships. Yeah, well, that's one, right? And Johnny Vedmore on Unlimited Hangout had a piece about the public relations firm behind a lot of this stuff, Edelman PR, which is a U.S. Public relations company. But it's interesting to see Biden mention this as well, saying that, you know, we have to enhance faith of government. That is that strategy is one hell of a way to restore trust. Mm. But, you know, I mean, basically what they're trying to do is get enough. They know they can't get the whole population on board, but they want a rabid enough segment on board and to entrench them even more in propaganda. Think of Rachel Maddow viewers, you know, right. you know, that demographic basically is what they're angling for because they do need some level of support from the population mm-hmm. To do this. But it's going to get really messy for them, I think. You know, not everyone is on social media and not everyone watches mainstream media anymore. And there's, you know, a lot of people that don't even watch independent media. They just don't watch anything and they're not going to be down for this in the States right. anyway.
Yeah. That's the engineered apathy, in my opinion, right? I think that's an absolute agenda is to just make, I think that's the whole kind of You know, I mean, you could say Orwell or maybe, you know, Brave New World kind of crossover, but the concept that you just batter people with conflicting information to where they just go, whatever, like, I don't even care anymore because I don't know what to look at. And so I'm just going to back down and just trust the general sentiment, you know, and that's to a degree worked. But I think, again, to the first point we said earlier, that the clumsy nature of what they've done this last year and a half has really jolted people out of that to just go.
Well, it's really arrogant of people like Klaus Schwab or the U.S. government, the Biden administration, to think they can restore faith in government and institutions so easily, given what they've helped enact over the course of the past year and how, you know, to varying degrees, they're being found out for it, at least more than they were, you know, a few months ago, which is important. But in addition to that, I wanted to touch on something you brought up earlier. So, yes, they do define as a class of domestic terrorists anyone who violently opposes forms of capitalism or corporate globalization. And as I point out in the article, that is a clear recipe to label anyone that doesn't like stakeholder capitalism, which is the World Economic Forum's name for this new inclusive, they say, economic system that they want to replace the existing economic system with. You know, basically anyone that's going to oppose that is going to be framed as an extremist. But also it opens the door for the Biden administration to go after, essentially, if they wanted to, everyone that voted for Bernie Sanders could easily be labeled socialist by the U.S. government, with them wanting to replace capitalism with socialism. And of course, these were a lot of these people were like, oh, vote for Biden and we'll push him left. Well, how the fuck has that gone? Sorry for swearing. But I mean, you're now a terrorist too, along with the Trumpers. So that didn't work out as you planned, huh? This is what happens when you trust the guy that writes the 94 crime bill to be the new, like, progressive FDR or whatever.
This is what happens when you trust the government. This is what happens when you trust the government.
Or the political establishment, right? So these are, like, political parties, technically, and what have you. But, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I kind of see this more centered around the Great Reset, right? Like, at least in large part, where it's going to become basically people who are resistant to this new world become extremist terrorists because they're stopping. Even if you make it a connection to, the connection to, you know, climate change, which is where they're even telling us that's going to happen. Then you make the argument, like, let's say you get to this climate change emergency that they're going to create, like they're going to claim it's happening.
Yeah. Where, Klaus Schwab said that too, that towards the end of the year, there would be that. Yes,
exactly. So if we don't, then it becomes like, oh my God, we have a 6 months. The new study says we're all going to die, right? However they frame it, then you can argue that people that are arguing that's not real, arguing that it's a lie, whatever, are literally putting people's lives at risk. It's the same thing they did with COVID, right? So it's a perfect recipe, and they can apply it however they want, right? So I think that's how that's going to be applied to the general sentiment of, you know, you're resistant to the new future we're building for you, you know, whatever it is. And it's just this is an obvious recipe for, as you pointed out, a totalitarian dictatorship, authoritarianism, however you want to look at it.
Well, what they're trying to do is frame, you know, people that don't want to do all this stuff for climate change or don't buy the COVID narrative as threats to the collective. Yes, they're claiming to be like guardians of the collective when in fact they're trying to enslave the collective so that they can be the little, you know, they can create neo-feudal society and, you know, live on top of everyone else. You know, and if you realize and use your brain and realize that this has been like the largest wealth transfer in history, these people have already basically created neo-feudalism. They just need to keep people docile for a little bit longer, just until they can get all this, you know, technocracy stuff set up so that this small handful of people can successfully control and micromanage the actions of millions and billions of people. Mm-hmm. You know,
yeah,
that's where this is heading.
Here's a interesting little just screenshot from somebody that shared this the other day, just to give people some perspective on the comment you just made. I mean, that this just blew my mind. Workers lost $3.7 trillion in earnings during the pandemic, and nearly 500 new billionaires joined the ranks of Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk last year. At the world's richest, became $5 trillion richer. So they gained more than even people lost. Like, it's just...
Yeah. This is a bigger wealth transfer than 2008.
Oh, absolutely.
But where's the Occupy Wall Street protest? Oh, what do you know? It's not here, and it's probably not going to come. And a lot of people that supported Occupy Wall Street are now saying, how dare you question the billionaires? They're just trying to help.
Right. That's a weird shift, isn't it? This weird crowd. Like, even people that have been like, their entire careers aggressively calling out the lies of the establishment around war are literally trusting the exact same people around COVID-19. It's just, it speaks to the ability of social engineering.
I mean, Bill Gates before COVID was like Monsanto's number one evangelist and was like, GMO foods will feed the world and they're not going to drive millions of Indian farmers to suicide and poison the environment and kill off the bees and
create
or give cancer to tons of people and not actually even increase yields at all, as I claim. So let's believe him about stuff we're going to inject into our literal bodies. It's nuts. It's been nice to see the Bill Gates fall from grace to an extent, but obviously it's a limited hangout, as I've written about, and doesn't go nearly far enough. And
he served his purpose, right? That's how I feel about it. I mean, they probably want to die even more, but I think the issue was becoming too apparent. It was very obvious, conflicts of interest and so on. And they just threw him out, and same with Fauci even. They're kind of just like shuttling him aside. And
but
it's
the
like,
foundation's still there, right? And even before Bill Gates was like a talking face, his foundation was there behind the scenes doing all of this stuff. And it's continuing to do that to a significant degree. Even if, Warren Buffett has left. So now it's technically just Melinda, I guess, calling most of the shots. But they'll just be wow, a woman philanthropist. Look how powerful she is. just like they did with look, Lockheed Martin is led by a woman now.
Right.
A woman now we're murdering the bombs.
Yeah. We're murdering countries with feminism. It is a sidestep. No, it's just exactly like with Donald Trump, Gavi, and the World Health Organization, right? And the idea where they go, look, we're stopping the funding, and yet we're funding five times as much through an outlet that goes right to them. It's about
this is perception management. Yeah,
exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Now, before we jump over to the next one, did you want to go through the pillars of this discussion? Or do you feel like we covered that well enough?
I didn't talk about them specifically, but we can go over it. So I just pulled up the article.
Yes.
All right, the first pillar is understanding and sharing domestic terrorism related information, including with foreign governments and private tech companies.
Right.
So basically, that's just going to be making new information sharing partnerships that the government is going to covertly sign off on that will not need congressional approval to share, all the information they amass on you with foreign governments Silicon Valley and vice versa. Yeah, Israel is definitely going to be involved. And we know this because of the extreme extent to which the Anti-Defamation League is actually involved and has been involved. And in this domestic war on terror setup, we talked about that in the election special last year. Mm-hmm. And I didn't get to it that much in this piece because I would have had to explain why is the ADL bad and exactly what are they doing, blah, blah, blah. But there's plenty there. The ADL has been doing trainings for the FBI about this stuff for a really long time. They recently hired a top ex-FBI guy to be like one of their vice presidents or something. So that, they're basically created this ADL-FBI revolving door. There's been several occasions where the ADL phones up the FBI and says, oh, we saw this stuff on 4chan, blah, blah, blah. This person's a terrorist. Arrest them. That's problematic. So why does this matter? The Anti-Defamation League, for all intents and purposes, focuses as an extension of the Israel lobby in the U.S. They're very much, an arm for the influence of that particular lobby, and their ties to law enforcement are very disconcerting. Beyond that, the Anti-Defamation League has lots of ties to the mega group, which is also responsible for Jeffrey Epstein, among other things. They're essentially, the national crime syndicate of the 20s and 30s for the modern era, rebranded as billionaire philanthropists. If you are familiar with my work on Epstein, you'll know all of that stuff. So I won't go into it too much there, but it's alarming that they're so involved and shows you that it's not really about terrorism. Right. One thing else I do want to say about this, though, is even though things are really polarized from the Trump era and they're closer to getting this agenda pushed through than they have before, I still think they have a ways to go. And that really concerns me because that, just like several months before 9/11, you had the framework introduced to create DHS. I am concerned that there is going to be some sort of event that will break out the war of domestic terrorism. Everyone's going to be talking about it, just like, 9/11 happened and, we have to take them down, right? Whereas a few months before, the American public was like, do we really need a whole new department and cabinet and all of this stuff? for the domestic homeland and all of this stuff, you know, most people would have been like, yeah, nah, I don't know. But after 9/11, everyone was on board.
Exactly.
So I think we need to be really vigilant about something being blamed on, you know, coming up that's big, being blamed on white supremacists. And it doesn't even have to be something as big as the Oklahoma City bombings. Okay. Which, by the way, if you want to know the real history of that, James Corbett has a great video on it that I would encourage you to go watch.
Yes. The discussions of these things blew me away when I first discovered this. It's like, what isn't a completely lied about narrative? You know what I mean? Like when you discover Corbett is a gold mine for that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But the interesting part about this is this cross, Michelle Chostovsky, Professor Michelle Chostovsky that Taylor interviewed, talked about this idea that what he sees this being built into is like the new world government. You know, like they're building out these public-private partnerships, the WHO, these different groups are becoming this governmental organization that will be essentially, you know, in effect, the world government without calling it that, you know, and that's the alarming development of where we see that going, you know, and the way this direction is leading to.
Yeah. Sounds about right. Well, I think that's the whole point of stakeholder capitalism is to make that a global model at some point. And if you look at how these different groups, like the Club of Rome, for example, which has a lot of ties to the World Economic Forum, you know, planned this out back decades ago, you know, different major regions, different blocks of the world, and then basically those coming under a giant international, you know, a global governance structure, but there's specific regions that manage, you know, their own affairs to a smaller degree. So people can still feel like, oh, we're not, you know, one people necessarily, but we're close, you know. But I think stakeholder capitalism is basically a recipe for that, because it's basically making corporations the government,
right?
For all, you know, intents and purposes, it's really what it is. If you read the fine print of what that's supposed to mean, and they have like the Vatican is on board with this, numerous governments, including the Biden administration, the UK government, you know, lots of governments have just been like, yep. Mm-hmm. We're going to do this. So, you know,
just like we talked about a minute ago, I mean, think about it like this. It's just as likely that this, that's already what we're living under, where corporations are effectively the government. And all they're doing is creating a justification for why that's now okay. We can now state that's the case, right? Like over the process, we make it to where, well, they're good philanthropy, public-private partnerships. They're working for you. I mean, the reality is we can see that that's the case now. I mean, our government is completely overly influenced by big corporations, big entities, you know, even, you know, international entities, you know, and we've seen this and talked about it. You've written about it, you know, so at the end of the day, it just shows you that this is just like they're rationalizing what they've already planned out for the future of nanotechnology, which is a point that I think this all ties back to. We're getting to the next article, the, you know, altering evolution with nanotechnology in 20 years. They said in 2002, you know, this seems like a justification for what they already plan to do, you know, using things that they can emotionally manipulate people into, you know.
And yeah, sure. And it's going to be a huge emotional manipulation thing. And I think that's really why we need to be really vigilant about some sort of upcoming false flag. And like I said, it doesn't have to be a big bombing. It could be something like a big cyber attack. I think the U.S. government just a couple days ago simulated all of the utilities in the U.S. being knocked out.
Okay. I actually think about like the crossover, and that's absolutely, I think, going to be like, it's probably more than one thing, to be honest. And the cyber thing. But remember that he talked about the cyber pandemic, which is obviously interestingly crossed over with the pandemic discussion. But I have been considering the kind of like Comet Pizza, and we've already seen the BBC already said anti-vaxxers have been sending death threats to all of our people. You know, I think that's where we're going to see this crossover. And I keep seeing that connected where.
Yeah, to an extent. Yeah. But I think they'll have like one big event that'll really push people over that'll have like a decently high death toll. So, for example, in cyber attacks recently that have gone on at like water utilities, they've talked about how hackers have tried to poison people that were served by that utility.
How about,
you know, so that could be something. It could also be something like we talked about last year, because they seeded the narrative for that as well. Some sort of bioterrorist attack conducted by white supremacists, or, you know, I the whole COVID-19 vaccine issue and the polarization there is going to be weaponized by this. But I don't really know if they're going to use that as the big event. But I think if there's enough smaller events of that, then they could probably, you know.
Well, we're obviously just theorizing, right? But I, you know, Oh, absolutely. But what seems to make sense that would be like a one-stop shop, and we've talked about this already, is a hypothetical, like you said, either an attack on you know, like specifically, it could be a bio attack, which would connect it all anyway, that leads back to Iran that work with white supremacists, or it could be an attack on vaccine infrastructure or vaccines specifically, right?
Yeah,
and that
yeah.
would then tie it in, and you could tie it back in the same way. And it basically achieves all of the things they're trying to accomplish.
Yeah.
Demonizing the anti-vaxxers as the terrorists, which this domestic discussion also includes, the sentiment for just any, you know, you're against this agenda, so that you're a terrorist, therefore, but, you know, it all ties together, you know, and these pillars you discuss in the article make it very clear that they're just building up.
I only talked about one. I can go over the other ones.
I didn't know if you really wanted quick. To just do the one or not. I was just going to generally summarize them, but go ahead. Yeah, if you want to go through them.
I already named the one that's about the information sharing. The second one is preventing domestic terrorism recruitment and mobilization towards violence. If you read the article, that's largely about censorship.
Yeah,
disrupting and deterring domestic terror activity. That's the dicey bit that also includes censorship and other things, legal action. It's about basically increasing the number of prosecutors, federal prosecutors, to a significant degree that go after people for extremism of various types. And then the fourth one is probably the nuttiest, because it says confronting long-term contributors to domestic terrorism. And the Biden administration says this means eliminating racism in the U.S. As they've, you know, probably polarized the racial divide and the race issue are just as much, if not more, than Trump in a very short amount of time.
You recently shared this with me, and I went over this in my show yesterday, just this, we don't have to play it, but the discussion of Biden and the whole nukes and F-15s discussion, you know.
What's
interesting is they talk about in the beginning, I'm blanking on his name all of a sudden. He's I got it right here, right in front of me. This guy right here, Garland.
Merrick Garland, yeah.
Where they come out in this discussion, and they come right out, and they're talking about guns, and it's gun, and it's and they talk. And the whole point about sending people out, and this is what I think that's actually discussing. That point is about sending people out. He says in this clip, like, we know who you are, we know where you are, we're gonna come, and we're gonna. So there, this is pre-crime. It's about sending people out to stop what they're gonna do before they actually do something. Right. And they're laying this out in front of us. And this is applying to people, like they're saying, just simply mobilizing towards it, which implies people like us we're trying to lay it out for. And I just think this crossover with guns and gun control and, you know, it's just like a one stop shop. And they're utilizing all these things to achieve everything in the same direction of our subjugation. That's what it feels like to me.
I agree. So I would say, one, don't give your guns to the Biden administration. That's probably a bad idea, given what they've openly started planning and announcing. wrong time to do it, if you were ever going to do it, is probably now. But the other thing I want to say, though, is that there is a way to beat this, I think, but I don't think it's the way most people are thinking. I think they're expecting, you know, dispersed attempts at protest, things like that. But I think the real way around this is counter economics and becoming not dependent on the government or these predatory corporations that are backing them in all of this.
Absolutely.
So I think to the greatest degree possible, we need to become local, work with local people to meet our needs to the greatest degree possible. And that's, just, you know, that's also true for like the vaccine passport that they're trying to link to economic activity down the line and all of this stuff. I mean, really, that's the way around it, is to just be like, well, fuck you guys. and just, you know, take care of yourself and your family in a way that doesn't require them. To the greatest extent possible.
Vote with your dollar. That's what I mean. I've said that for a long time. It doesn't have to, today, it doesn't have to mean the US dollar, but it just means vote with your financial power. Because that's my opinion, your actual vote in the context of our democracy doesn't actually do anything. So your dollar and your vote with your money is the only thing I feel like truly respect, you know, because imagine if every American suddenly just stopped buying things. That would collapse. I mean, that would be catastrophic, right? So they know that there's a power there, you know? And so I agree completely. And I think we have to find those peer-to-peer economies, you know, work with people, trade, barter, right? These are things that are within your power, you know?
Yeah. Well, this is much easier to do in small town America. So, you know, maybe this isn't great advice for people that live in big cities.
Fair enough.
But, you know, if there's enough small towns around America that are like, bye, you know, government and giant, you know, Westlink corporations or whatever, if there's enough of them, I mean, that would start to pick up steam, I would think.
I think
in terms of talking about counter economics, I think it's beyond just a personal boycott at this point. I think it's definitely like communities need to come together and say like, we're not going to play ball here.
Like Derek's article about the Mexican cities that were doing that.
Yeah.
They came together and said, look, we are opting out of your political system, and they let them do it. You know, it's like, it's about having that. Yeah, I completely agree. And it's a bottom up kind of a thing. We need to continue to do that. And you're right, to your point. I mean, yeah, if you're already living in a smart city, you're probably not going to be able to figure that out. Right. But it's about,
well, like, you should try and work towards leaving if you can. Yes, right. Yes, but I think this is much more feasible for communities that are already kind of small. And generally speaking, in the States, like, small towns tend to have people that would be more on board with that type of stuff, given what's going on and what even people that aren't, you know, as paying as close attention to this stuff as maybe our audiences are, know is likely to come down. I mean, obviously, it's a massive period of global instability, you know, so, but I, you know, if you go to a big protest or something to try and stop this, or, you know, if you're on the right, for example, and you try and get a bunch of people together to go storm a Capitol in your state or something like that, no, that's not going to go well for you with this new framework. They're just going to take you to prison.
Yeah, even if you're peaceful, right, to your point. I mean,
like, yeah, exactly. So that's why I'm saying, whatever, you know? we have to look at this a different way that doesn't, you know, feed into their game, basically. Totally.
And I would add to that, though, at least for me, no way am I saying you shouldn't go out and protest. I think that's something that has an effect, but be aware of how that can be used and think outside the box. We have to think of other things to do, too, you know. But the last thing I want to say, and we'll jump over to the other article, is the interesting way they're using this rise in murder to justify this, right? That was the thing we discussed. That was the what they discussed in this discussion, right? They came out and basically said, we've seen this rise in murder from 2020. So when I asked in my show, what else happened in 2020? Well, that's right, this massive uprooting. You know, it's like there's so many other things that happened there, including the rise in domestic violence, or the fact that there are plenty of psychological things we could point out, you know, whatever. A lot of stuff to discuss, and yet they're just kind of saying, well, it was because murder, because guns. It's like, and there's really no evidence to say that's exactly what it was, and so on. But the interesting part about it is even Bill de Blasio admitted in his discussion of this that, well, it's clearly tied to the pandemic. People are cooped up. They're angry, you know, and it's like, yet they're already trying to say
they're poor.
Right.
They've lost their jobs.
Right. They're angry. They're unhappy. They're psychologically unfit. You know, the point is that now we're using that even in 2021 to be like, oh my gosh, murder is up, you know? And I just think this is disingenuous for obvious reasons. And I want to make sure people see that. And by the way, the increase seems to be a lot in a short period of time, but we're way lower than we were in 1990. So it's just about perspective. You know, they're trying to jam this through to make you feel like you're in danger, when in the reality is we've basically been continually decreasing in crime for the most part since, you know, the 90s down to 2019. And now we see a jump and they're like, oh my God, we're all going to die. You know, just ask yourself whether there's more going on in that narrative. You're right. That's all.
All right. Since we're moving on to the next article now, I do want to mention something that's actually related to both. And if you remember back, I guess a month or two on Unlimited Hangout, I had a piece about Biden's push to create a HARPA, a health DARPA, in the U.S. And originally HARPA was pitched as a way to stop mass shootings in the U.S. before they happen under the Trump administration. And now Biden's framing the exact same thing planned by the exact same people as a way to stop cancer and all of this stuff. Right. But HARPA, what that will be in the Safe Homes program, that's the flagship program of HARPA as it's been designed, is going to be intimately connected to the war on domestic terror. Because it's not just they're going to detain people and whatever. This is mandatory mental health treatment also for people that mobilize towards violence. And if you read this article and then you read the strategy, I mean, it's pretty clear, because I may have mentioned it at a point or two in the article, but I really want to stress that. And basically the next article we're going to be talking about is how even though HARPA in the U.S. hasn't gotten off the ground yet, there is a global health DARPA now that combines basically the former DARPA directors that went on to make the Skunk Works, or basically the DARPA equivalents for Google and Facebook, teaming up with the Wellcome Trust, which is second, maybe I actually probably on par with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation in terms of influence over what's happened in the past year or so, including the vaccination campaign and really everything else. And so they have teamed up to create a global health DARPA, saying that COVID-19, not unlike Klaus Schwab, presents a narrow window of opportunity and is the catalyst, for this new health innovation age. Like the launching of Sputnik created the space age, right? Well, really, it created a space arms race, didn't it? So not even really an apt analogy, but basically,
Maybe. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, there does seem to be a race in regard to this new genetic, you know, I mean, a lot.
They frame it as that, right? We have to beat China and we have to go farther than China, right? So, I mean, they frame it that way. But I mean, you know, a lot of the people doing this in the US and the UK and whatever are working to do the same thing in China, and the Chinese government's on board. So, good point.
Maybe, and yet I keep making that point in general. It's just as likely that they're all working together in this. That's why this seems to be a global kind of a push.
Well, I think even like Russia and, you know, their governments are on board with this to an extent, because I think, you know, well, we talked about this before with the National Security Commission on AI. You know, there's two factions, the ones that want to duke it out and have an actual war with China and Russia, and then the Henry Kissinger, Eric Schmidt faction. That thinks if we just build this Orwellian hellscape together, we don't need a war. Like, we won't nuke you, China and Russia, if you build this Orwellian thing with us and join our, you know, elite cabal or whatever. I definitely think there are people in those governments that were like, yeah, that seems better.
That's always an important point to make clear, is that it's not always just an all-encompassing agenda that the government's again. You know, there's always multifaceted things, even from the top down. Like, there are things that it seems that they're on board with, right? That seems like there's a kind of general direction. But, like, I point out the underlings. You know, you look at, like, a Gavin Newsom or, what's her name, Lightfoot. You know, making ridiculous jumps in the narrative way before it seems they're supposed to, for obvious personal gain, right? And I think that is just them trying to make moves that has nothing to do with the larger agenda. You know what I mean? And so it's, but nonetheless, there is a direction, you know, and it's like that comes from a certain, you know, collective, in my opinion, you know, the elitists, if you can call them.
Yeah, fair enough. So I don't know if you want to start with going into the details of this or not, or if there was a point you wanted to start with. I can just...
Well, just the crossover here, which is very, very alarming. And this is what I was setting the tone for before, and what I've been talking about pretty constantly since for a lot of this whole COVID-19 illusion is this obvious. I mean, every single new advancement that's happening, not even discussing the like 14 or what was it? Way more than that. I think it was like 30 different platform based new vaccine directions the WHO is working on, even though we've barely approved these things today or haven't approved these things today. Every new development, whether vaccine or medical related, is nanotechnology. It is new genetic alter, all these different directions that are not what Americans seem to be. This is the direction that they are choosing for us.
Yeah.
Just to point out about the article I wrote, the deceit of Western medicine, and how the Rockefellers and the Carnegies, as James Corbett has clearly documented, just took the harness and or the reins and led them into a direction of petroleum-based petrochemicals or to petroleum-based medications instead of what seemed to be a more likely healthy choice, which he continued to use, which was homeopathy. So I think that's what's happening here today. Again, they are again shaking the reins and taking the direction they want, just like the security state to the biosecurity state, like the evolution. And the nanotechnology part of it is a huge factor, which speaks to the converging technologies document that brought up a lot. And this ties in with the direction of this article, which is the idea of pushing in a direction, utilizing people that have already been in this direction of transhumanism, as James Corbett puts it, the extinction of the human race. And that's basically a stated purpose. They just don't do it that way, right? So
get to that. It's at the end of the article where that actually comes from. That's been the plan since like 1957. That's nuts. So there's a lot of different places, to start here. One thing I wanted to bring up, pursuant to your point, is that in 2019, Eric Schmidt, the former CEO of Google, who some of these DARPA directors worked directly for, at the time in 2019, when he was in charge of the National Security Commission of AI, which is Silicon Valley in the intelligence community and the military, all coming together to decide this stuff, he basically was like, it's the area of healthcare where we're going to push for AI and emerging tech first. And this was before COVID, right?
What year?
It was 2019.
Okay, that's interesting. Go ahead.
A year before. Well, obviously, a lot of the infrastructure for this was set up well in advance, right? Yeah. So, yeah, including Welcome Leap, which was actually planned out from beginning in 2018. But wasn't launched until after COVID had already started.
Go ahead and explain that for me, because that's included in the title, and I made kind of a pun with it, you know, their welcome leap into transhumanism. So go ahead and just explain what the Welcome Trust real quick and Welcome Leap is, and we can start from there.
Okay, the Welcome Trust is a global charity, Yeah, they're the richest medical research organization or charity, I guess you could say, in the world. They're intimately tied with the UK government and also a lot of the academic institutions in the UK that have been very prominent during the COVID era, Imperial College London, the London, I think it's the School of Tropical Medicine and Hygiene, something like that. A lot of these schools that pop up over and over again have a lot of ties to the Wellcome Trust. It basically functions in a lot of ways like the Gates Foundation in terms of its funding, influencing the direction of science, specifically biotechnology, to a huge degree for decades and decades and decades. But the Wellcome Trust is much older than the Gates Foundation, which wasn't launched until like 2001. The Wellcome Trust has been around. I forget exactly when it was formed, but it was formed out of the assets of Henry Wellcome, whose pharmaceutical company was Burroughs Wellcome, which is actually what GlaxoSmithKline is today. The Glaxo and GlaxoSmithKline was added in 1995 after a merger. The Wellcome name was dropped from the company, but GlaxoSmithKline is the Wellcome company today. So the Wellcome Trust is basically, you could describe it as the charitable arm of GlaxoSmithKline.
So it's a vaccine company. That's great, right?
So well, they fund vaccine research to a huge degree. And if you read the article that got me kicked off of Patreon about the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine developers and the Wellcome Trust, you'll see that they were intimately involved in basically the people that developed that vaccine work for Wellcome. And a lot of people that work for Wellcome are also tied to the Galton Institute, which is the UK Eugenics Society. They didn't change their name until 1989. They waited over 40 years after World War II to take eugenics out of their name. And they named it after Sir Francis Galton, the guy that made eugenics. He's the founder of eugenics. And instead of calling him what he was, a racist pseudoscientist, they call him a brilliant 19th century polymath. And among other things, they host the Wellcome Trust when they open their medical archive center. The first medical archive that they wanted to store wasn't, you know, actual medical information. It was the historical archives of the British Eugenics Society.
It just blows my mind how obvious this is, and it's not shocking why it would be deleted, you know, but it's such an obvious tie to even still with the name, it's an overt eugenics society. It's based on, you know, and yet that's so directly tied in influencing the direction of the vaccine program.
The president of the Galton. The president of the Galton Institute today, her whole career was basically at Wellcome.
It's just incredible.
And that's like normal, I guess, if you look at the Galton Institute's board, all these people that are like basically overt eugenicists are prominent academics all throughout the UK, and they're not named and shamed out of it. It's been very normalized in the elite institutions here. And so it's not a surprise to see why, you know, the Wellcome Trust is as influential in the UK as it is, and also globally. So, you know, it's really... Yeah. I would consider it sort of a UK equivalent of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, but much older and with even more money.
Yeah, it seems to suggest that there's an obvious underlying, like if it's multiple places, multiple leading like Western countries all quietly supporting this without saying, it clearly seems that the elitist backbone of all of these governments are involved or aware that this is a direction they're trying to accomplish. Maybe they think it's for the greater good. I've never believed that, but it's happening, you know, and look at what we're dealing with today. Right now it's coming out. I might be doing another show today about this because it's so important. There's stuff that's coming out today, more and more information about the injections and how plenty of like very, very prominent scientists and doctors are actually speaking out, Wall Street Journal even, and saying, this thing's actually dangerous and we shouldn't be giving it to kids and blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And it's just, look at what's happening. Look at all the evidence that's being ignored, all of the side effects and all of the effects, the damn, you know, how about the fact that it's being forcefully given to people in the UK who only have disabilities, or giving disability, you know, do not resuscitate orders to people who have disabilities.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
60% of the people who died of COVID in England, we're told, are only people with disabilities. That's not a coincidence. So there's an obvious overarching thing. And I know you pointed this out a lot. So for the people listening, there is Whitney's work, first and foremost, make sure you check this out in regard to this. But there is a long track record throughout this of obvious examples of eugenics.
Well, we'll take the example of the AstraZeneca vaccine, which I was trying to warn people about in December that was going to be bad, right? It's been banned by numerous governments now.
Italy, by the way, just did it for everybody under 60 because of an 18-year-old girl that just died and had thrombosis, vein issues throughout her entire brain.
But COVAX, which is part of CEPI, which is heavily funded by both the Wellcome Trust and Gates, that's their main vaccine that they're giving to the developing world, the one that's just been banned by the developed world.
Right. That's always how that goes. That's always how that goes, you know?
Yeah, well, it's happened before with vaccines like the polio vaccine, the live polio vaccine that was banned in the US and the UK and elsewhere is now used in the developing world. It was offered to my daughter in Chile. No thanks. In the US, they use an inactivated polio vaccine. But they give, you know, they still want to keep making the one that's not so good so they can make money off of it, right? So obviously, you know, Google is invested in the AstraZeneca vaccine. The UK government itself directly invested in it.
People that are censoring discussions about this, and they're the ones that are financially tied to it. I can't believe that these are not even like it's so these are every point we go over like that alone is enough to show you that they're intentionally ignoring that. Like that's an obvious conflict of interest and the media doesn't care about it. Right. So it's so obvious how involved they are with obfuscating.
And I really encourage people to go read my article on the Welcome AstraZeneca vaccine ties, because it's just abundant. It's a very important microcosm of how influential this is with the vaccine industry. I mean, basically, the Oxford Jenner Institute is full of Welcome people and people that both work there and at the same time at Welcome. And in Welcome groups in the UK, like the Welcome Sanger Institute, I think in 2019 it was, had a huge controversy because they were accused of, they do a ton of their experiments in Africa specifically. And they had harvested DNA from people for a purpose that they was not the purpose it was actually used for, and are in a huge legal conundrum for illegally harvesting the DNA, of African people for.
Damn. Is this the correct one?
Yeah, that's the one.
Yeah. I mean, it's just so sickening how continually this can happen, you know, where they cannot, it's not like they get caught doing something that they're like, oh, it was unethical, but we didn't act like they're knowingly doing something that's overtly illegal and just simply immoral. And they get caught for it. And they just continue. I mean, it's like Pfizer getting caught bribing doctors, manipulating safety results countless times. And yet we just, now they're altruistic, you know, working for us, saving people. This is such an obvious agenda. It makes my teeth hurt. You know, it's really crazy.
But, you know, the Wellcome Trust essentially functions as, the moneyed arm of the Galton Institute, really, for all intents and purposes. I mean, their ties to the Eugenics Society before then are very overt. And as I note at the end of this article, the former head of the Eugenics Society, Julian Huxley, yes, a close relative of Aldous Huxley, of Brave New World, the Forest Director General of UNESCO, is not only one of the most rabid eugenicists to ever exist, who just a year after World War II said, we must make the unthinkable thinkable again with eugenics, fresh off the bat. But he's also the guy that coined transhumanism and said that that would be the next era of eugenics to basically use the eugenic science of genetic engineering, his words, and combine it with, merging of human and machine tech to create a new organism. So it really is, for all intents and purposes, the destruction of the human race as we've known it. Corbett wasn't exaggerating when he made it, stated it in those terms. So
by definition, transhumanism is you know, at the very least, irrevocably altering the human race. I mean, that's literally what that is. And whether it can change, you know, make it extinct I think that's an obvious reality. And as I always play, since it's a quick second clip, it's important for people that haven't seen it to recognize this is not an opinion. This is an openly stated concept. And as I keep referencing the Converging Technologies document from 2002, as well as the follow-up in 2017, they clearly reiterate the point that we're talking about combining your biological and your technological identities. That's physically.
What the fourth industrial revolution will lead to is a fusion of our physical, our digital, and our biological identities.
Pretty clear.
Oh, right? Sorry, I was stretching my neck while video was playing because it's been super sore.
I wanted to ask you about a point you make in the beginning of the article, which I find very interesting, is that they're talking about specifically the global health DARPA, known as Wellcome Leap, is talking about to achieve a breakthrough scientific and technological solutions by or before 2030. Now, I just find that so ridiculously telling that everything seems to be lined up in these same
2030.
Right? By 2030, you'll own nothing and you've never been happier.
That's a conspiracy theory,
right? Right. Like the WF can openly talk about that. And it's fake news, you know? So what are your thoughts on that? And do you think there's any correlation there? Like, is that?
Yeah, no, I absolutely do.
Yeah.
Obviously they can't have this drag out for too long because they won't be able to implement this hellish future without people catching on. They have to do it relatively quickly and keep things locked down. To do so, right? And keep things from being normal and, flood the zone with their propaganda and what have you to, keep everyone as docile as possible while they set all of this up. But it is interesting. So they have a couple different goals, and some of them are 5 years and some of them are 10 years. But they, you know, this is why I think this article is really important, because they're just starting it now. They're not quite there yet. And so a lot of this stuff we can stop, because a lot of this depends on research that's going to be done at universities. If you go to the Wellcome Leap website, you can see their global network of universities. Those universities, people can show up and be like, stop, they have, the research directors of these particular programs, including the insanely awful one trying to make literal babies and toddlers test subjects. They have names. They have offices. You know, they have emails.
Right.
They can be contacted and told, you can tell them your exact thoughts about what you think they're doing. I would encourage you to do that, because it's time there was some pushback for this kind of stuff, because it's really hard for them to justify this under the guise of COVID-19, trying to, surveil babies, make, 80% of children 3 and under have their brains mapped by these maniacs within the next 10 years. I mean, hell no. I mean, I just don't understand. People just need to understand what they're trying to do, because really the people that, Wellcome Leap isn't the only organization like this. The Gates Foundation has one that's teamed up with Facebook and Google and EcoHealth Alliance, even, and all of this stuff. To a large degree, the pandemic planners, if you want to call them that, have moved to planning the post-COVID era, and they're setting it up right now, and they're just starting to set it up. So they're not, they're planning to have us locked down for a while longer. So this is why we really need to be mindful of what they're setting up now, and it needs to stop before it gets to their end game. We can't let them do this to toddlers in 5 to 10 years.
Right. Or now
around the world. Yeah, well, no, of course not now. But it's going to obviously start off small with university studies,
That's my point, though, is that not to say that, it's okay now, but not later, right? Is that more so that I tend to point this out, that yes, they're going, 5, 10 years down the line, we're going to be shooting. It's probably already, if they can initiate this in the next week, they'll do so. You know what I mean? And I think they tend to point these out as a lofty futuristic thing, yet they're already in the process of, which is basically what you were saying, and that's the alarming part of this, is that they want you to think this is, I make the analogy, in 1950, if they were to talk about flying cars, people would be like, okay, that's not even relevant to my life. But if they came out with flying cars 2 years later, the idea is that it's something that people wouldn't even be understanding. And that's what's happening right now with nanotechnology. They've been told about this as if it's some future thing that we're going to be doing 20 years from now, and it's literally being initiated. So when they're talking about artificial intelligence, mobile sensors, wearable brain mapping, as you pointed out, for children 3 years old and younger. And this is exactly my point. This is all being pushed in during a pandemic, we're told. Why are we revolutionizing our medical direction, or even just our health direction, during a pandemic in the first place?
Yeah.
But it's because this is the set agenda. Whether utilizing what's happening because it was just a coincidence, or they made it happen to achieve it, it doesn't change that they're abusing the situation and driving things that I don't think Americans want or care about.
Yeah, no, for sure. And the people that bought the COVID narrative this whole time really need to wake up, because there is no reason with even that official narrative to justify this crap.
Yeah.
Okay. So, people in independent media who were like, oh, I don't want to rock the boat on COVID, rock the boat on this shit, because there's no reason to let this go forward. I mean, there's no excuse.
Rocking the boat on COVID if we're talking about some foreign policy discussion, it's one thing. This is a worldwide agenda that is literally affecting everyone's life on the planet. So if you're an independent media out there that's going, oh, I don't want to rock the boat, you're not a journalist. Sorry to say it, because I'm tired of playing this game where people are hiding from this topic, and it's affecting literally everything, including foreign policy, including your health, including your rights. Sorry, I just had to say that because it's
frustrating. I mean, some major parts of independent media are talking about stuff that happened several years ago, like it's the biggest story today,
or talking about themselves for that matter as the story, which is usually what happens for people. Look at, you know, we are now the story. You know, it's anyway. But back to the point on this, I wanted to talk about. What you were getting into is the people themselves, as where you start off with. I think that's what you were touching on, right? Is the alarming crossover of these individuals first, which is just going from the fact that they're already pushing the direction we just talked about, even though it doesn't really seem to align with what we need. These are people who they're using to drive this agenda. The statement is it's for your health. Have alarming ties to counterterrorism, to the same kind of eugenics, kind of technocratic direction. Well, speak on that for me.
The key point here is that they've been trying to commercialize the same technology they're telling you now through Welcome Leave is for health. They tried to do it in the past for surveillance and commercial purposes. So obviously, it's not about freaking health.
Like everything else, right?
Like this wearable stuff to map your brain. Right. This lady here, Regina Dugan, who heads Regina, I guess is how you officially say it, whatever. You know, her thing, she took over, set up basically the DARPA equivalent at Facebook, which used to be called Building 8, to make their mind reading wearable. So you can just type with your thoughts. Jeez. Right. Now they're saying that needs to be used for healthcare.
That's your point.
Welcome Leap.
That speaks to your point, right? Where, you know, Facebook and these social media platforms are just kind of like a segue. They're utilizing these to test out these systems, right?
It's like Well, I've written a considerable amount about Facebook. Facebook is basically a front for DARPA's failed LifeLog program. And it has close ties to DARPA. Why else would they pick, let's hire ex-DARPA director Regina Dugan to head our DARPA equivalent in the private sector? You know, I mean, it's...
I just think the counterterrorism crossover is just ridiculous because that's everything. All of the COVID-19 stuff has ties to either like things they've used on prisoners or tracking cattle or, you know what I mean? They're treating us like terrorists and people that are risk because that's how they perceive it based off the domestic terrorism thing we just talked about, you know?
Right. So let me just go over Regina's past a little bit. So, yeah, you mentioned counterterrorism stuff. She was at DARPA from 1996 until I think 2001. In 2001, she became special advisor to the Army's chief of staff just in time for the invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq. Then she creates a defense contractor called Red X Defense. Which gets her in trouble when she's director of DARPA, because when she's director of DARPA, she hands out a bunch of contracts to that firm, including for technology that's supposed to detect IED bombs for troops in Afghanistan that was found to not be any more effective than flipping a coin to determine if a bomb was there or not. Bet that'll make a lot of veterans mad. It should. Yeah. Anyway, beyond that, when she was at DARPA, she founded the Transformational Convergence Technology Office. Code for? I think Corbett and his work on the transhumanist stuff has noted that it's often called like a convergence agenda. That's the word they use for it a lot.
Digital convergence. That's the new document they just came out with that he covered.
Right.
Very alarming. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So this is similar. So that office doesn't exist anymore because it was folded into the Biological Technologies Office, or BTO, at DARPA, which was made in 2014 and is still around today. And BTO focuses on, they say, everything from programmable microbes to human machine symbiosis.
Programmable microbes. Kind of sounds like the virus mimicking nanotechnology that Charles Lieber was working on, right? Sounds interesting and similar.
Sounds related.
Yeah.
So basically, BTO also frames a lot of this, obviously, transhumanist, mad scientist stuff is health focused to a large degree. But the key thing about her time at DARPA, it was actually Dugan that greenlighted the agency's investment in mRNA vaccines, which that technology comes pretty much entirely from DARPA. They invested in 2013 in both Pfizer and Moderna's mRNA vaccines. And what are the mRNA vaccines on the market now? Wow, that's interesting. Right. The hand of DARPA, and specifically this lady, guided that to reality. And the person that... Dugin, basically lobbied Dugin for this, and she put in charge of that program a guy at DARPA named Dan Wattendorf, is now the director of innovative technology solutions at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation.
The fact that she is involved with the green lighting the actual mRNA technology injections that are now being utilized, and she's coming full circle back around to like, it's these are impossible to miss connections. The fact that, you know, I made that point in the beginning, and I think on a show with you, the fact that we easily called that Pfizer and Moderna were going to be the injections used in this country.
Yeah, in January 2020, yep. They called that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And here we are.
Because they're the DARPA-backed vaccine guys.
Exactly. And they, yeah. And there's also the conflicts of interest to Fauci and the people that work with him. It's like, there's so many, or Moncef Salawi for that matter. There's obvious ties, but, you know, here we are. But yeah, that blows my mind, that the continual thread you can tie through all these, which is what your work usually does a great job in showing you. You know, that they're all tied together.
So anyway, after she leaves DARPA, Dugin goes to the private sector, and she is put in charge of Google's Advanced Technology and Projects program or agency. Forget exactly what a group. Sorry, Advanced Technology and Products Group, which is abbreviated ATAP. Why she was there? She built the basis of what is now Google's augmented or AR augmented reality business. She created something that they call Project Jacquard. Which is smart clothing, which has teamed up with Levi's and I think Yves Saint Laurent.
Yeah, that's tied, very tied to COVID. We've already talked about that on the show, how there's this big push now for these specifically, you know, and nanotechnology.
It comes from this lady. It all comes from this lady. She also, you may have heard over the course of the past year in relation to COVID, the idea of a digital tattoo as a vaccine record. Well, years before, Regina Dugin was promoting the digital tattoo to unlock smartphones, and also the digital RFID chip authentication pill that you swallow and turns your entire body into your authentication token.
I'd never heard of that until Dugin. That is crazy to me. You know, and it's just another another form of all the stuff they're trying to accomplish right now. You know, the internet of bodies is what that sounds like to me, you know?
That's exactly what it is. And this lady is an architect of that, you could argue. And why she was doing this for Google, she chaired a panel at the Clinton Global Initiative, and also attended the 2015 Bilderberg meeting that had a whole huge section about it was on AI. Eric Schmidt was also there, who at the time was Dugin's boss. Pretty interesting.
I know you mentioned it a second ago, but I just want to reiterate that, you know, to make sure this is clear, that there, as you wrote, a military investigation found that she had violated ethics rules to the point we were discussing before.
Yeah.
And yet it's all continues forward, right? So she can literally violate ethics. They can find that in an investigation, and yet nothing changes.
Hey,
why? Because she's clearly invested in what's the direction they're taking. I mean,
Totally. Well, like in the UK, the health secretary, Matt Hancock, just got caught having this affair all of last year. And he's been in numerous scandals over the past year and several months, and he's unfireable. He could literally shoot some person in the face in the street, and I don't think Boris Johnson would let him go. Anyway, people like that are just too important and too on board, and they don't sack him unless they absolutely have to.
Right.
You know, Dugin's like that as well. So anyway, she leaves Google. She goes to Facebook. Facebook, their DARPA equivalent was called Building 8. It's called something else now. I forget exactly what. But basically, as I mentioned there, she created their non-invasive brain-machine interface technology, or rather set up that program that's leading to that. And earlier this year, Facebook actually showcased prototypes for that wearable now, several years after the fact. I think this was back in 2016 when this first started. Mm-hmm. So now we're in 2021. It's taken them several years to do it. But now they have a prototype that can supposedly anticipate the movements of your hands and fingers from your brain signals alone, and also anticipate what you plan to type with your hands before you would type them. They claim it won't be able to read your mind, but, you know, trust Facebook as far as you can throw them, you know.
This is the kind of point I made a moment ago, is that, you know, you can look back at what they were arguing years ago. And they'll clearly state, like, this is obviously, you know, the direction where we're already at a point where we can basically read your mind or estimate what you're going to do based on your synapses or whatever. And now today, the more up to date, and they're like, well, we're not sure. You know, it's like, it's just interesting how it gets more convoluted when it gets closer to actually happening. And that's something.
Yeah. I think consistently they oversell their technology a lot. And they act like it's going to come sooner. And so I think that's given some people that research in this space this feeling of inevitability that we can't beat them or challenge them. Mm-hmm. And I honestly think that's inaccurate. I think these people thought AI would be much more advanced now than it actually is. They're desperately trying to produce the singularity. I don't think they can actually produce it. I think they've just run into too many problems and that AI doesn't do the stuff they want it to do. I mean, they want to replicate consciousness in the machine, and these are the most unconscious people on the planet. So, you know, I don't think it's going as they plan. So, you know, some people research this stuff and based a lot of it on the hype that these people put out on their splash pages and whatever. Yeah. But I think it's important to have the nuance there. We also have to keep in mind that AI, even now, like Diagnostic Robotics, the IDF link company that we wrote about, that I wrote about for T-Lab last year, their company says their AI to predict COVID outbreaks before they happen is 78% accurate at best. Yeah. And that hasn't been vetted by independent people. It's probably way lower. It's probably 50%. Right. But even if you believe the company, which has a reason to oversell its capabilities, it's wrong like one out of four times. Right. Okay. These guys can't have all these systems running on this crap and have it fail so often. So, you know, obviously I think there's a lot of hubris and arrogance involved. And I think that doesn't get factored into the discussion enough, because I think people need to realize that we still, you know, they've taken this pretty far, but we can still stop this.
Absolutely.
I really want to make that clear. This isn't like inevitable. They're not inevitably going to win. That's actually what the elite want you to think. And people that are framing it as such are actually playing to the hands of their agenda.
Yeah. That's my opinion. That's something that Corbett points out all the time too, that this perceived like omnipotence, you know, is not really necessarily there. They definitely are powerful, you know, but they're also pretty damn clumsy a lot of the time. And just people, you know, we can go off on that for a while, but the point is, I agree completely. And we shouldn't overestimate how, you know, well they could be doing or how powerful they could be. I want to add one point really quickly back. I was going to say something about the IDF I thought was really interesting, or specifically the Israeli government. I don't know if you just saw, but Los Angeles County is now going to be using IDF veterans as law enforcement to protect Jewish communities. Isn't that incredible.
That's like the Jewish Defense League coming back.
They're going to argue, well, they're veterans, right? So it's not, you know, this is a real world implementation of law enforcement from Israel's government in the United States. I mean, it's just crazy to me.
Yeah, that's bad news. That's bad news.
Very bad news.
Okay.
But I just want to throw that out there because I thought it was interesting, the crossover we talked about before.
Well, maybe that's a way to get people in the U.S. to care more about IDF war crimes when they're happening in California.
Great point. Because you know that they will. I wanted to ask you about, to go back onto the Wellcome Trust article, about how she responded in an interview. I think that was this one here, about being asked specifically, and this is what I think is so crazy, directly asked about who they serve, essentially, who the program serves, the welcome
leader. Yeah. So the question was, so when you worked at DARPA, you had a very specific client that was the US military. So who is Wellcome Leap's client? Right. And she gives this long-winded answer trying to be like, blah, 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 blah. There's lots of things happening and you know, all these moving parts. And then eventually she gets to it and she's basically like, the biotechnology and pharmaceutical industries and international organizations.
Like the UN and public.
Like the UN and World Economic Forum. Well, in a separate part of that interview, she's like, you know what? I'm a big fan of public-private partnerships.
Of course.
So, I mean, big surprise there.
So this group,
someone that went from DARPA to Google. I mean, come on.
Right. Well, so this group that's ostensibly working for the American people is clearly working with the people who have a vested interest in doing things at your expense. That's fantastic, right? It's ridiculous.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, this lady has cultivated a persona of like, I'm a rebel. Like, she wears like leather jackets when she gives her talks and she's like, I do epic shit. Ha ha. And everyone's like, ooh, she swore.
You know what that reminds me of is what Caitlin Johnstone just tweeted about, how she's making fun of like Blinken's bio where he's like, you know, I'm a dad and very amateur guitar player. Like these, like the humanizing things they put in their bios, right? It's like, I think these people have entire teams that like try to make them seem human.
They do, though. That's what PR agencies on, you know? Do.
Crazy. But that means that they, like the point I made in my show is, why would a normal person need to convince you that they're normal? Just think about that for a minute, you know?
Yeah. Well, not to go back to Matt Hancock, but my favorite example of him trying to be normal was when he tried to cry on TV.
Oh, man.
And he's literally like smiling. I mean, he doesn't even know how to cry. They were probably like, you need to cry to look human and humanize the issue. And he can't do that.
Don't you think it looks like, I mean, look, it's not like crying is okay, right? Adults can cry. Men, women can cry.
It's a fake cry, though, is my point.
No. That's what I'm getting to a point. I'm saying that happens. But my point is, isn't it also odd that any leader would cry in front of what is that? If one, it seems like slightly a weakness to do that in the front of people, but also the fact that it's unnecessary. Like it serves only one purpose, to emotionally manipulate people who are watching, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think that was the intended point of that, but I don't think it really worked because he can't even fake cry on camera. He doesn't even know what crying looks like. I guess he's a sociopath, obviously.
Right.
anyway, so going back to Dugan, because there is a lot of this to get through still.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
She basically left Facebook pretty abruptly after like 18 months or so. And then was like, I have to leave to focus on building a new endeavor. And that was at the end of 2017. And the only thing that she's joined since has been Welcome Leap, which was officially began being built in 2018. So it's very possible she was contacted by people in the Welcome Trust before then. And they were like, let's talk about this new idea. And then they didn't really start officially laying the groundwork until several months later in 2018, because she actually stayed on Facebook a couple months after into the first part of 2018 to like transition a new leader or whatever.
So what was Welcome Trust's stated direction in 2018?
Oh, they were going to make a Welcome Leap, this new global health DARPA.
Right. So it's interesting to see that this was something yet again planned out in 2018, which, by the way, was the same year that the Europe document talked about planning passports in 2021. So it's, you know, this beginning moment seems to.
Or the National Security Commission on AI was made that year as well. That
hard to make all these things tied together. Yeah, they're all starting at the same time, and they're all at the same time.
It was a big year, I guess, for these guys.
What a coincidence.
Anyway, so in addition to that, she's also, in addition to being Welcome Leap Lady, she is also a member of the CFR-sponsored task force that includes Eric Schmidt, Reid Hoffman, and Viant Science Advisor, who is also tied to eugenics, and Jeffrey Epstein, Eric Lander. So she's part of that fun crowd,
right?
I guess you could say.
And Brittany's covered all that. We've talked about on the show before, Lander. This is the alarming connection that we should be concerned about.
Well, Lander's important because he's going to be leading Biden's HARPA, health ARPA for the U.S., right? So it's interesting to see them teamed up there at a CFR thing, of all places. Anyway, so there's another person that's the chief executive at Welcome Leap. It's a guy named Ken Gabriel who worked with Dugan. He was her deputy director at DARPA. He did national security research before then, was a big guy at DARPA in the 90s, is considered the architect of the micro electromechanical systems industry, which has a lot of this nanobot type stuff to it. Going back into the 90s dominated a lot of research projects that received federal funding in that field for a long period of his career. And he worked after Dugan left DARPA, he followed her to Google and they worked there together. Then he joined this national security focused laboratory called Draper Labs that he led up until he was plucked out to become chief operating officer of Welcome Leap. So, but one thing that's interesting about this guy, Ken Gabriel, and I think your audience might be interested because it ties in with a lot of the warp speed stuff that you, me, and Derek all covered, is that he's on the board of directors of Galvani Bioelectronics, which used to be led by Moncef Salawi, head of Operation Warp Speed, who was actually let go from Galvani Bioelectronics for well-substantiated claims of sexual harassment.
What do you think, really quickly? I actually think that might have been something totally just a thought, but he was somebody who was an obvious focal point from us, obviously, but so I bet you they just got him out of the way because it was an obvious connection to what is now becoming the director.
But at the same time, like you were just saying, there's some people they can't kick, like they just don't care, you know? So maybe he pissed off the wrong person. There's a lot of things. I don't want to speculate too much.
He was just a big Well, it's only coming from me, not Whitney. The red flag here is simply that he was a very, very clearly focused person long before COVID on in bioimplantables, bioelectronics. Yeah. And so if he was in the leading position of where this then goes, we would be vindicated. You know what I mean? Right. So it's a thought to have, but either way, they need him out of the way.
Right. Well, aside from Munsef Salawi, Galvani Bioelectronics is important because it's basically a joint venture of GlaxoSmithKline, which, as I already mentioned, is, you know, the Wellcome Trust is deeply tied to them and their history. And the other side of it is Verily, which is a Google subsidiary that's also doing most of the COVID testing on the West Coast of the U.S. and amassing that genetic data from those tests as well. But Galvani Bioelectronics specifically, as you mentioned, is about making these bioelectronic medicines that modulate nerve signals to end disease. I mean, it's basically a recipe for transhumanism disguised as medicine. Anyway, that guy being there and also at Wellcome Leap is pretty significant.
Oh, yeah.
The other guy that's important here is the guy that directs the Wellcome Trust. He's a guy named Jeremy Farrar. If you go and read this article, you will see that he had not only a major role in shaping the narrative for the COVID-19 crisis, but also for past epidemics and pandemics, including the avian flu, which, of course, you know, that was used to create a lot of fear and hype back in 2004 under the Bush administration, and then made Donald Rumsfeld and his investments in Gilead, a pharmaceutical company he ran before he was Secretary of Defense, a ton of money because they overhyped the danger of avian flu and whatnot. And so the federal government bought a bunch of Tamiflu, which is produced by Gilead, and raised their stock price. And Rumsfeld made a ton of money and they lied about it. So anyway, the origin story of that thing Farrar basically made up, and no one, you know, it was kind of discredited even by the World Health Organization and stuff, but the media stuck with it. Yep. And that was way back then. Yeah. Yes. And so now with COVID-19, if you had followed, so for example, the Fauci emails, you'll see Jeremy Farrar pop up there over and over again, the director of this charity. What is he doing telling Fauci what to do? And why is he one of the most heavily redacted people in those email communications that were released? Yes. Something to consider. But one thing I didn't really point out in the article, but I would like to point out on your show, is that picture right there. Wellcome Trust, in addition to being teamed up to a very significant degree directly with the World Economic Forum, is also teamed up with the Nuclear Threat Initiative. And the Nuclear Threat Initiative was covered in the Engineering Contagion series. You can see him there with the co-chairman of NTI, Sam Nunn, who was president at Dark Winter in 2001. One of the, you know, the basically the exercise that, you know, produced the anthrax attacks and has ties. Also, the people that did Event 201 were involved in Dark Winter. Here's Jeremy Farrar hanging out with us, Sam Nunn, as they talk about how they can work together. It's worth pointing out, too, NTI wasn't just Sam Nunn in the Dark Winter crowd, because there were other people at NTI that were at Dark Winter, too, like Margaret Hamburg, who's now at the Gates Foundation, and was in Cladex and a lot of these other Johns Hopkins simulations. But the other co-founder of NTI with Sam Nunn is Ted Turner, owner of CNN and probably one of the most outspoken depopulation billionaires of all, which is why he hasn't been rolled out in front of the media in multiple years, just because of how blatant he was about, yes, we must reduce the world population by billions and billions. And things like that, you know, once they start saying that stuff so blatantly and publicly, they tend to sort of pull them out of the public eye a little bit. Right. So,
Yeah, it's just, and by the way, as you've made clear, and I've pointed out since reading your work on it, is the Dark Winter discussion is clearly being pulled into the COVID-19 discussion, right? I mean, they keep telling you, no, Dark Winter, it's going to be a bad winter, right? So it's just the tie-ins just are, it's just comical. You know what I mean? It's like you could literally, like, I think this event of all of COVID-19, once somehow we're past it, if that happens, somebody needs to go back through and like make an outline of how ridiculous all of this is and how obvious it is. So you could have predicted, and by the way, we did, all of the way this is going because of how obvious the ties are from the beginning. It's just about whether you're willing to think outside the mainstream narrative. You know, that's the problem right now. But I think
I think this is also important to see just the interconnectedness of these same institutions that teamed up together in a big way last year and are planning to continue teaming up in a big way into the future, but how they've really been doing this in a way that's really been able to slip in the radar in the past years, and they have a very obvious end game But anyway, I don't want to spend too much time going over Farrar, but there's a lot more on him. And actually, myself and a couple other people that contribute to Unlimited Hangout are going to work together to do a big deep dive on the Wellcome Trust, because like I said, they are just as influential as the Gates Foundation. A lot of people did really good deep dives on them. Probably the other big power faction that's been super influential on that scale is going to be the Rockefellers, Rockefeller Foundation, Corbett, who we've been talking about a lot. But to his credit, did some really great deep dives on both of those, but no one's really done a big deep dive that I've seen anyway, I could be wrong, on the Wellcome Trust and their influence, their history, who Henry Wellcome was. Crazy dude. Beat his wife with a whip. Crazy dude. Anyway.
I was going to, go ahead. If you're not done, I was going
to
ask a question.
No, I was just going to say that, the Wellcome Trust from their history back to this, to that guy all the way up to now, have been super influential, and they really need to be exposed for what they are. One thing I forgot to mention about the Wellcome Trust is that it's not actually a charity. It's a mix of Henry Wellcome, when he died, planned it out very specifically in his will, exactly how this was going to be set up. And it's basically a scheme to make something look like a charity that's actually for profit. So you have the Wellcome Trust, and then under it, you have the Wellcome Foundations, even though they're called foundations, they're for profit foundations that work closely with the trust and coordinate.
Honest, right? Very honest setup. But I quick question, just kind of when you mentioned the Rockefellers, and this is something does your research suggest that the Carnegie Foundation, the Carnegies in general, are in any way involved with any of these directions?
Well, I think so. Yeah. The Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and all that, like they're involved in a lot of this stuff, but also Carnegie Mellon University, which if I'm not mistaken, the Mellon family is like a big banking family from New York that teamed up with the Carnegies to make that university. Ken Gabriel led their like national security technologies office that was specifically made to give feed technology into the national security state after 9/11 and all of this stuff, and are huge for AI and a lot of this tech. That's coming out. So I think, I think they do have some involvement, but I haven't looked into it specifically. But we do know, for example, as I covered in April, for TLAB, the World Economic Forum teamed up with Carnegie to basically plan out how a cyber attack will collapse the existing economy and allow central bank digital currencies to sweep in and take over everything. And then and the call to merge intelligence agencies and banks and their regulators all together.
They're involved. You could look at that as two sides of the same agenda, right? I mean, you got Carnegie over here pushing the cyber attack angle of this, which is the same. They both lead to the Great Reset in different angles or different, what they ask is obviously because of that point they made before. And the idea that these are the same two leading families, it doesn't have to mean that they're the same two leading everything today, but that we're involved with the redirection of our medical history, happening again in the exact same way. I just think that's that's an important point that we shouldn't be missing, that they're doing the same thing. And that just means that we arguably haven't changed. The illusion of what we are has been fluctuating while the same leading people are still driving the bus. You know, that's what it feels like anyway.
Sounds about right to me. You know, I haven't really looked into the Carnegie stuff specifically, but I do know, for example, Margaret Hamburg, who I mentioned earlier for my Dark Winter research, her father, who was really involved with a lot of this national security state stuff in the decades prior, was the head of the Carnegie Endowment for a long time in New York.
Interesting.
And really influential and pretty shady. And his daughter's very shady as well. I think she was actually FDA commissioner under Obama before becoming involved with the Gates Foundation. But she's had a very storied career since Dark Winter and TI.
Of course.
So anyway, there's one more person I want to talk about at Wellcome Leap. The key part of this that I want people to focus on, and I don't know if you're going to make clips on this, Ryan, but I would really encourage someone to make clips about the specific stuff about the programs Wellcome Leap does. I think it was important first to go into who these people are, to show their conflicts of interest, that they're shady, and they're obviously lying to you about this research being about improving global health.
Right.
It's clearly something else that's going on. But the programs themselves are just like nuts. And the one about toddlers and babies that I mentioned in the subtitle, you teased a little bit, is totally insane. There's no way this should ever be allowed to happen.
Well, it just shows you their focus on children, which is obviously happening right now with the vaccine, which is really alarming.
It's not even, so they're saying like with children 12 to 17, which is technically like preteens and teens. And then there's, this push to do, test vaccines on kids as young as 3 and stuff like that. This program is infants, three months on to 3 years old that they want to do this to in this specific program. I mean, that's insane.
to clarify that for people, they're right now already pushing and already doing in some cases tests on
infants
on 2 months old and up, which is sickening to me, right? Yeah, you're right. Yeah. They are. It's important to make sure we're clear on the 12. You know, you're right. I mean, kids is kind of a not correct, but they are pushing to get.
Well, I still think that's wrong, by the way, to do that.
Oh, totally. But your point is, the point is they are still pushing in to that level of
beneath
12. They haven't gotten it yet.
You know, I think these people, I think these people are empowered by how people have been like, okay, it's fine. Use the experimental mRNA stuff on infants and toddlers and little kids and bigger kids and preteens and teens, you know, people roll over for that. They're rolled over. Then they'll roll over for this. Why not? You know?
Yeah.
And I think we really need to tell them no, because, you know, you can't really make this, oh, you're anti-vax because you don't want us to like hook up little kids to like this brain reading stuff and surveil everything about them and all their movements and where their eyes move and all of that. It's insane. Anyway, we'll get there in a second. So anyway, I want to talk about this one last guy who's the main director at Welcome Leap.
Go ahead and keep going through it. I'm still here. Just keep going.
Okay. So like the three main people I already brought up, like Regina Dugan and Ken Gabriel, and this Farrar guy who, by the way, Farrar is the one that came up with the concept for Welcome Leap, or we're supposed to believe. Anyway, so the last person I want to talk about is this guy named Jay Flatley. You probably never heard of him or his company Illumina, but basically Illumina basically run the gene sequencing hardware and software industry. So even companies like 23andMe or the Ancestry.com consumer DNA test, by the way, Ancestry.com is owned by Blackstone Capital. You know, they take, although they basically just use Illumina software, right? So like this Flatley guy, for a long time dominated that industry. It's currently led by an ex Microsoft guy at the moment. And Flatley is still, you know, their executive chairman of the board of directors, in addition to his role at Welcome Leap. And he's also, of course, very deeply tied to the World Economic Forum. People at Illumina's executive team talk about how they envision a world where people will be genetically tested from birth to grave for both health and commercial purposes. Isn't that interesting? And then at the World Economic Forum, Jay Flatley goes on a panel with Matt Hancock of the UK and talks about how babies need to be gene tested at birth for various reasons. And then some people on the panel say that soon that should be made mandatory.
Yeah,
so terrible. These people are nuts.
You mentioned 23andMe. I think that's just an interesting crossover into the article you wrote, Bill Gates, the BGI, even to what's her name, Wojcicki's sister tied to 23andMe. Like, this is a weird crossover between all of this. And I don't know why that story didn't get more discussion about how there's an obvious tie between the genetic, you know, to China, essentially, from Bill Gates to BGI. Yeah. And none of the people in Paul, the two-party illusion, seem to point that out. You know, it's just very strange to me.
Yeah, well, I think for the two-party illusion to continue going, there needs to be a lot of animosity towards China at the right and see them as the bad guys and not see that the good guys, i.e. the U.S. government, is working directly with them.
Well, why wouldn't they point that out then, is my point, right? Isn't it alarming that you would be like, look, Gates is working with, you know, I don't know, it's interesting. But there's the crossover was my point, that they're from YouTube CEO to genetic testing for your, you know, the constant crossover between all these people.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. I totally agree. Well, you know, another thing, another organization I hope to write about soon that's very similar to Welcome Leap and is one of those cases of pandemic planners now planning the post-COVID era. One of the people on the board is the China lead for the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and that's partnered with Facebook and Google. Mm-hmm. Google, of course, being closely tied to 23andMe because the CEO is Sergey Brin's wife and the sister of the YouTube CEO, as you mentioned. So. Yeah, it's pretty nuts. Anyway, so I guess that's all I really need to say about Flatley. So I'll get into the programs, if that's okay. So there's four programs. So the first one that they made is they abbreviate as HOPE. Isn't that nice? God. More hopium.
Always like that.
Yeah. So HOPE actually stands for Human Organs Physiology and Engineering. It has two goals. So one of them is to basically grow organs and basically grow a body with an immune system, not a brain, but, you know, organs. And they say they'll be able to use that in lieu of animal testing for vaccines. But keep in mind, too, how they threw out the animal trials for a lot of these vaccines that happened with COVID-19, how the animal trials were actually problematic and they ended up skipping them to go straight to human testing. So do you really want to trust these people with making a model they say eliminates the need for animal tests so it can go straight into people straight away on this infinitely smaller regulatory timeline that is obviously was an issue for and helped cause what's happening right now. I wouldn't, and these people have numerous conflicts of interest, as we pointed out, with the pharmaceutical industry and the biotech industry. And as Regina Dugan basically said in that interview, that's what Welcome Leap works for.
right.
You know, so I don't think they care about animal welfare and all that stuff. I think it would be nice to eliminate animal testing for cosmetics and really everything, because I don't really think it's ethical. But these people are very, very unethical, and they're not doing it for that reason. Right. I can promise you that. So that's just one of the program goals. The other program goal, they say they hope it to eventually lead to growing basically human organs that can be implanted into people, or bioengineering organs that be implanted into people. But they say in the shorter term, and it's not clear if they'll move, they'll actually move past the shorter term to the longer term, is to get basically a mix of synthetic, like machine, and human organs into people.
You know what's really, really interesting about that point? That I just talked about this yesterday. Right now, there's a discussion about the breeding of machines, like reproducing of machines. And right now, it's a setup where they have like a digital basis of this, where the machines can pick the best traits of the previous machines and utilize them going forward, and then essentially build their own species. And so what's really crazy about that is essentially the infrastructure for what we're talking about on a physical side and what you're talking about over here, or I guess kind of both. But if you create a situation where you can build, grow humans, organs, whatever, you could effectively combine those two things and create.
When I was reading their program description of this, that's sort of what I saw happening, because as we'll see in the other programs, they plan to create basically in silico as opposed to like in vitro or in vivo model of a human brain. So what's stopping them from putting the robot brain into the human body they grow? Be able to get away with this and have this actually work, right? But this is like what they're planning to do.
I caution that might exactly be what's literally already happening. History's rife with examples of that, where they float the idea that they've already been testing for 10 years. You know, it's just something to consider. Yeah.
Well, I'm sure they've been testing it, but I don't think they have this stuff ready as a way that'll like fool people and actually be functional. Because I don't think they're going to get AI ever to the point where they want it to be. And I think that's why they need some of these programs, specifically the second one we'll get to in a second, the toddler child one. I think they need something, a program on a massive scale like this in order to get it to that point, or so they think. And that's why I think this stuff specifically is so important to stop.
I agree.
Sorry about that. Okay. So, so that's basically the first program, the HOPE program. In the interest of time, I'll go straight to the toddler program. They call this the first 1,000 days, promoting healthy brain networks. Isn't their logo nice? It's a little girl smiling and it's rainbow colored and she looks so happy to have her brain mapped by the crazy eugenicist and DARPA people. This is insane. Anyway, so as you can see here, it specifically wants to use infants from 3 months up to 3-year-old toddlers. It's being overseen by this woman named Holly Baines. I linked to her LinkedIn there. Maybe you should send her an email, depending on what you think about this insane program. So basically, they frame it as a way to make sure that all children have healthy cognition and no one gets left behind. It's sort of framed in that no child left behind way. We all know how well that worked out, don't we? after Bush introduced that. But anyway, they officially say they're focused on developing, quote, objective, scalable ways to assess a child's cognitive health by monitoring their brain development from 3 months to 3 years. And then using that to, as they say, risk stratify children, place children in different categories of cognitive ability. Wow. And a lot of this, of course, ties down to their genes as well. They want to make it interactive with genes, right? So stratifying children. obviously
that's, that's exactly what that
yeah,
is.
Yeah, but I haven't, this is just like the first paragraph. So jeez, like, let me keep, this is the most insane shit. I mean, when I saw this, I was like, all right, I was going to do this other article. I was going to do this other stuff, but I'm going to have to write about this because we have to stop this. This is insane.
Before you jump to the next part, how invasive is this? Is this like invasive or is it something that goes on the outside of the head?
You'll see. Okay. So basically, not only do they want to put children in these different categories and predict how they'll respond to potential interventions into their brain function, right? Mm-hmm. They basically say that one second, let me find the right part so I can I can get the punchy quotes. So it says that artificial neural networks, which is a subset of AI, have demonstrated the viability of modeling network pruning processes and the acquisition of complex behaviors in much the way as a developing brain. And they go on to say that machine learning can now be used to extract meaningful signals for the brains and infants of children. And the way they want to do this is the use of low-cost mobile sensors, wearables, and home-based systems in providing a new opportunity to assess the influence and dependency of brain development on natural physical and social interactions. And they say this can be done with continuous visual and audio recordings in the home, i.e. 24/7 surveillance of little babies and kids. They grow up getting used to literally having cameras on them 24/7, recording everything they do and everything they say, as well as what they say, relatively unobtrusive, scalable electronic badges that collect visual, auditory, and motion data, as well as interactive features like when they take turns, pacing, and their reaction times, as well as wearable sensors that assess physiological measures predictive of brain health, electrodermal activity, respiratory rate, and heart rate, wireless wearable EEG technology, or eye tracking technology.
Remember, the Perfusa is considered a wearable, and that's an implantable. They call it minimally invasive. That's an implantable chip, just so we're what they call wearables, right?
I mean, who knows how far they'll take this, but basically, you know, it's pretty extreme to, because as it notes later in the description, within 10 years, they want this to be done on 80% of kids.
What's an interesting side of things, which I'm sure you point out, is that that obviously leads to the normalization of them, like you said, being surveilled and watched and tracked, which they already are, but now they're going to be that's going to be okay to them, right? They're going for 80% of the new generations, you know.
But this is basically done so that algorithms can decide what of all of those factors indicates is a healthy brain, and then develop interventions to make the children's brain healthier.
Right.
And basically what they want to do is that there's three different goals. So the, or stages of this, right? So the first one is to basically use all that stuff I just mentioned to develop an artificial neural network, a brain, a machine brain, basically, or a model that functions like this. And once they have that, which they call this in silico, model of basically a human child brain. They want to compare children's brains to that as a baseline. And if a child's brain isn't like the AI brain, they will intervene to make it like that. Let's just stop for a second and think about what that means. So these people, the Wellcome Trust programmer people, okay, and their AI are going to develop the baseline for what a human brain should be like. And if your kid's brain isn't like the AI brain, okay, they're going to make your kid's brain like the AI brain. That's what this program is trying to get to within 10 years.
As an alternative, though, to a point that you've said before, like, remember to your point that they've struggled to actually create the singularity because they can't actually accomplish the machine.
Yeah, they want kids to do it for them.
Right. So they're going to use your kids, just like they're trying to use today, to get that done using their brains, and then apply it the same way. And then, of course, go back to the direction you just said, right? I mean, that seems like the obvious, right? But as always, using your children under a guise of helping them for their benefit, for, you know, the benefit of the government, I should say. That's quite alarming. Yeah, transhumanist.
I mean, it's absolutely insane on multiple levels that anyone would be cool with that.
the fact that they're openly arguing about intervening based on things they've decided are what it should be. How is that even acceptable conversation? Like in every other context, that's like, woo, that's dangerous. But now it's okay. You know, it's like, it's just incredible to me. That's eugenics and people need to understand that. Yeah, this is definitely going to be a clip.
The eugenics stuff is so explicit because they frame it as, oh, we just need kids to be cognitively healthy and we don't want any kid to be left behind and have underdeveloped cognition. But then they say, not only can we use it to make kids go from underdeveloped to normal cognition, we can use it to make kids go from normal cognition to like super cognition, which is obviously eugenics. It's not about you know, a health thing. That's about like designer babies and shit like that, like getting into that kind of territory and human augmentation. And there's a couple other programs that make this stuff really explicit.
The question is always the same. Who decides what's normal? Right? Who decides who is a terrorist? Right? It always comes back to the authority figures deciding the direction. And these are people we shouldn't be trusting. Pretty simple.
Yeah. I mean, this is, you want to trust ex DARPA people, ex Silicon Valley, mad scientist people, and eugenicist welcome trust people to do this stuff to your kid. This is just nuts. And there's actually one that they announced just this week that's sort of similar for adults we'll get to in a second, that's supposed to treat depression, but only the symptoms of depression that keep you from being a good worker. Not symptoms of depression that like actually improve your quality of life or improve your ability, capacity to feel pleasure when you're super depressed and stuff like that. No, it's just stuff that might interfere with the rewards based system in your brain so you can keep working for the man.
Right.
Pretty nuts.
Yeah. All right. Jump into it. Cause that speaks to the whole like Prussian based school system. I pointed out in the past that's, you know, they're the whole system that we create is designed to build obedient workers.
So yeah.
That lines up.
Well, that new program is called Multi-Channel Psych. There was one I was going to get to before that's called Delta Tissue, but I can just skip it.
So whatever you want to jump into.
Well, I just basically in the article, I did it in the order they've been announced. So Delta Tissue was the one announced before Multi-Stage Psych. And basically what that program is that it's like a lot of the stuff that we've covered in the past year, honestly, Ryan, stuff like predicting diseases before they happen. Mm-hmm. And if this program's allowed to advance and be normalized, basically what it will do is allow people to gene edit you before you have the onset of any disease. They're like, well, you might be susceptible to this, so let me give you this experimental thing that's going to change the function of the nucleic acids, i.e. DNA and RNA within your body, and see how that goes. And of course, as I note in there, you know, a lot of this stuff relies on CRISPR, which study after study shows causes an insane amount of damage to people's DNA that they can't fix afterwards.
There's evidence of nanoparticles doing the exact same thing, integrating and altering your DNA.
Nanoparticles
alone, right? Go ahead.
For this article, I was reading about Moderna well before COVID. I think it was an article from 2016, and it was talking about how their nanolipid particles in one of their early mRNA vaccines, they had too little nanoparticles that didn't work, and they had too many, and then it was toxic to everyone that
took it. Exactly. And that what's weird is I pointed the exact same thing out. So they realized that if they increase the lipid nanoparticles, they can increase the reactivity of it, but so too the adverse events. And so suddenly they just managed to solve that. Nobody talks about that, right? They didn't, though.
Skip
the animal trials, which would have shown that was the case. And there you go. Right. Perfect.
Yeah. So anyway, this Delta Tissue thing is really basically a front for a way to basically say they're predicting medicine before it happens, but it opens up the door to just a crazy new era of eugenics, saying that you can gene edit this person and that person. And it's all based on precision medicine anyway. So, you know, that is code for gene-based treatments. And this is well before COVID-19, right? And this is, you know, like Moderna and the mRNA vaccines and all of that were framed as precision medicines and framed actually in media reports, as I link in the article, as gene therapies before COVID-19 most of the time. And it's just, I mean, basically the idea is that, you know, they genetically sequence you and they decide what sort of treatments you should have. And they give you these interventions before you have any disease. And they frame this as saying, oh, well, we'll eliminate disease forever. Do you really trust these people with that? I mean, these are like like Biden level platitudes of like, ooh, utopia if you vote for me and all of this stuff. And look what you got with Biden, right?
It's medical pre-crime, which you've called it before. It's medical pre-crime, which is why I pulled this up, just to point to the infrastructure. They're already building what we've already talked about, the airborne detections that they called big news back when we covered it, right? This is our the contract's there. So now all they got to do is say, oh, look, there's an airborne thing. We're about to get sick. Come in for your genetic alteration. You know?
They tried to do that after the anthrax stuff, and they couldn't quite get it off the ground, but now they can, or they think they can.
Now it's rolling. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So anyway, I won't go into too much detail then. with that one, I'll just go into the multi-channel psych one, which is the sort of like the toddler one, but for people. But it is a little different because basically they want child brains to basically build them a robot brain that's human enough to be the singularity, which is clear indication that they know they can't obtain the singularity without getting this done to enough kids. Ugh. I really want to stress that. Stopping specifically that program is essential. And parents groups around the country, not just in the US, but in the UK, where a lot of this stuff is based, should really start getting involved and being like, no, you know, because I mean, if you're going to buy their bullshit that this is about making kids brains healthier, you read the program description, it's not about brain health. It's about making this artificial brain.
They're studying your children to achieve their goal. That's what this is. And surface level.
Well, to advance artificial intelligence, and it's not anyway. Yeah. So this last program they say is about revealing the mechanisms of, I think it's pronounced anhedonia, which is like an aspect of depression, but it's specifically this aspect of depression that has to do with making it harder for you to work when you're depressed, not actually about making you not depressed.
Yeah. Well, you don't feel any better, but you'll still go to work.
So they frame it as that. And they basically say, well, I have a pull quote there in the article where they say the problem they're trying to tackle. I'll just read the quote. We understand synaptic connections serve as the currency of neural communication, and that strengthening or weakening these connections can facilitate learning new behavioral strategies or ways of looking at the world, right? So remember that they talked openly about sort of intervening and changing those connections in the brains of children to create new behaviors and create new perceptions, right? So they're talking about here about basically doing the same thing with adults, okay? This is fucking nuts. This is nuts. This is like end game level stuff. Please pay attention to this, people.
Well, think about what they're already telling you, right? Build back better. The Great Reset. This is exactly that. They're telling you, and they always have been. I mean, this is one of those points from before. How silly is it that Biden can literally run as his tagline is build back better, and he's pretending like that's not connected to anything. Meanwhile, you've got every other country going build back better, all saying it. It's an open conspiracy. It's childishly obvious, right? And so that's what this is. They are changing your world, your life, the way you live it, whether it's the AI discussion or anything else, without your permission or what you think is best. This is scary stuff, and you're right. We should be paying attention.
So anyway, going back to this quote, it says, you know, we have discovered that emotional states are encoded in complex neural network activity patterns, and that directly changing these patterns via brain stimulation can shift mood. Okay, this is like their future of psychiatry and psychology for you. And I really want to go back again to the war on domestic terror, read that strategy, and you know, my reporting on HARPA for the U.S., which is basically Welcome Leap for the U.S., okay? Mm-hmm. This is going, you know, you have wrong think? Uh-oh. Once they get this technology, they'll be like, you're depressed. That's why you're having these naughty thoughts that are anti-authority and anti-government.
That's an interesting point, Whitney. I didn't even think about that. So basically, I mean, see, it doesn't even have to be under the guise of you're being depressed. It could just transition into, well, you have these dangerous ideas. So
mobilizing towards violence, dangerous neuropsychiatric warning signs. Wow, this is the stuff they're using in the domestic terror strategy, which is intimately linked with the HARPA stuff, as I've mentioned. As I mentioned in that article on HARPA, it's all tied together. This is the global version for it.
I just had a vision of like 1984 with the things on their eyes. Like, this is, you know what I mean? Like,
this is the same stuff.
Not 1984, but Clockwork Orange, or you know what I mean? Like the same kind of idea where it's like,
yeah,
they're neurologically manipulating you so you see things. That's some scary stuff. I can't believe this is not being talked about outside of your work and not many people anyway.
Welcome Leap was made last year and I didn't hear about them until I saw this thing and I was just like, what?
This is some sci-fi stuff. This is crazy.
Yeah, well, the thing is they're setting this up. They're setting it up now. That's why I keep saying we can stop this, but we need to like think about how to stop it. But I think we definitely can. Because these people aren't expecting to be paid attention to. Like these researchers at the universities don't want to be hassled. They're not used to being hassled for stuff.
Right.
I think they should get a lot of emails and a lot of phone calls, you know, and pressure on the universities that employ them and stuff like that. I think that's what needs to happen. And that definitely can happen if you can get university professors canceled because they were pro-Palestine on CNN. You can get these people fired from their universities. You know what I mean?
A little more important. They're trying to literally alter the evolution of your children, you know, just a little more than supporting Palestine. You know,
if enough people complain, they're not like, like I said, these people aren't used to being pushed back at all. And it scares them. It scares them a lot. Yeah. Like as one example, this guy from the BBC that like a bunch of people hate, he like walked on the street and people threw stuff at him and yelled at him.
Right.
And they had this huge reaction. BBC bumped up all their security. They're not used to that. These people aren't used to that. Okay. Yeah.
Well, I love it because that's him. Like he deserves to be called out. And what I loved is that nobody was being violent. They were yelling, right. But they weren't pushing, touching, you know what I mean? And that was, but the point is that was one of the first things I pointed out that said, look, this seems to be the beginning of the, you know, anti-vaxxer. Like they're going to frame that as some tied into the January.
Yeah, but thing. This you can't frame as anti-vaccine. This is leave our kids the F alone.
Yeah.
You know,
well, that's what the transition becomes, just like this health direction where it's like, yes, COVID-19 revolutionized how we view it. And now it's going to be for the next thing that does tie in with this or, you know, however they make that happen. And that's what we're seeing climate change, at least partly already beginning. You know, it's just wherever they take it.
Right. So going back to this program, so I went over that quote. So there's another, let's see. I want to find the bit on the, because there's a lot. You know, it's normally I could remember the facts, but here with this stuff, I just want to read you the stuff straight from the horse's mouth, because I think it's pretty telling that it's coming from them. Like, don't just take my word for it. These are their words. Okay. So it says, right, that it's the treatments of depression they want to make in this program, just like the previous one, it's precision medicine tailored to your specific biology, which includes your genetics, right? They want to see which populations have a higher risk of these different things that cause depression, you know, or, you know, aren't as good workers and all of this stuff. Right. And as I mentioned earlier, it focused specifically on this thing as anhedonia, and they define it. There's different definitions of it, but they define it as an impairment in the effort-based reward system. And they also frame it as the key they frame it as the key symptom of depression and other neuropsychiatric illnesses, not just depression. Right. Mm-hmm. So it's already moving the goalposts a little bit. Right.
Right. Right.
And it's very interesting, this focus on effort-based reward system, because they say, we're just focusing on that. We're not focusing on any other part of depression at all. I think that's pretty telling. And then they have a footnote at the very end where they say, quote, while there are many definitions of anhedonia, we are less interested in the investigation of reduced consummatory pleasure, the general experience of pleasure, or the inability to experience pleasure, i.e. what actually makes people who are depressed.
Right.
Anyway,
the part that matters, right? Like we don't care about helping you. We care about helping the
yes. Cause. So anyway, it goes on to say, rather, we will prioritize investigations of anhedonia as it relates to impairments in the effort-based reward system, e.g. reduced motivation to complete tasks and decreased capacity to apply effort to achieve a goal. Work for the man, basically. I mean, it's wild. So anyway, as I say, they're only interested in treating stuff that keeps you from being a good little worker bee automaton, and they don't actually want to improve anyone's quality of life with this. So is it really about improving health and ending depression forever? Or is it making sure, you know, they can medicate you and manipulate your brain enough to keep you plugging away at whatever meaningless task they have put you on or data mine you for whatever, so you'll be compliant and a good little slave? It's right. Basically what it is.
Exactly.
So the question becomes, how do they want to do this? Well, as I mentioned earlier, this is precision medicine. So they want to go into your genome, in a different, your microbiome, how your how the neural connectivity of your brain, how your brain processes rewards, how your genome is tied to how reward processing functions in your brain, and all of this stuff. And basically they want, they say in there, they basically want to use wearables for this, which is pretty nuts. And one of the things, the stuff they want to develop are new wearables that will quantify your mood based on biometrics such as voice and facial expression, your sleep, movement, reward system functioning, effort, motivation, and energy levels, social interaction, caloric intake, and HPA axis, which we'll talk about in a second, HPA axis output in real world situations. So I want to point out that Amazon's new wearable Halo already quantifies your mood, your emotional state, your sleep and movement. So they don't really have to go that far. But what's interesting is they want a wearable that can detect your effort, motivation, and energy levels. Imagine them producing this and corporations of the future mandating it for use. Oh, worker X is not motivated enough. Time to send him for some brain stimulation.
What does it sound like? It's social credit, which can be applied in the same way. And that's the wearable transition, in my opinion. Like, this is all going to become a one-stop shop thing that can apply.
Digital dictatorship.
Right.
You're not run by enough. The corporations of stakeholder capitalism.
Or tie in the Facebook work that they're already working on, and whether or not they can tell that, well, he's thinking dissident thoughts right now, at least. You know what I mean? Like, that's the way that seems to go.
I want to bring up this guy that the people at the WEF and also Mark Zuckerberg love. And his name is Yuval Noah Harari. We've talked about him before. I did, Johnny and I did a big video breaking down everything he said at his last Davos speech in 2020. He basically said, as soon as wearables come out that can read your thoughts, we are in the age of digital dictatorships and there's no going back from that. And he's telling this to the WEF people and basically being like, you can make this future if you want. Gee whiz, you know?
Right.
I mean, it's pretty nuts. But one of the examples he gives there is a government doing this is, imagine that you know, everyone in the state you live has to wear one of these things, and you're watching a speech by the great leader. And even though you outwardly look like you're happy and you're clapping, inside you're angry, but the wearable knows. And then the next morning you're in the gulag. That's what he says. Yeah. And he's saying that to the audience of the people that are literally building this stuff. So that's what they think too. Okay.
Or how about you just have someone knock at your door, right? Just as a first step, you know, I mean, that's the way this is going. Someone goes, hey, you know, we noticed that you were a little unhappy yesterday. Did you want to set up a genetic appointment?
Yeah.
You know, it's like that, that's where this will go. And it transitions.
Yes.
Thoughts lead to violence and so on. Right?
Exactly. This is so tied into the war on domestic terror. I really want to stress this. Yeah. Same deal. Yeah. Same deal.
This is scary stuff.
Yeah. So anyway, I mentioned the HPA axis, one of the things they want to monitor. So that's the axis, I guess you could say, between the adrenal glands, the pituitary glands, and the hypothalamus. That regulates not just how you react to stress, but also your immune system and your fertility are impacted by this. So they can intervene, and just from your brain and stimulating those parts of your brain affect how your immune system function, how well it functions, and how fertile you are, in addition to supposedly treating depression.
And don't ever forget about the crossover. All this stuff can be used, weaponized, which, I mean, essentially is anyway to us, but like, we could aim this over there and be like, you can't reproduce, or you can't feel a certain way. You all feel unhappy. You know, it's like, these are things that the military, I promise, has already considered.
Yeah. There's another thing here too, that's just beyond the wearables, where they want to make things they say are non-invasive that can, quote, directly interrogate the brain state. So, you know, so if you were saying they come to your door and you were a little unhappy yesterday and you're like, no, I promise I'm not, or whatever, they take you into one of these things and they can know exactly what's going on. That's at least what this is outlining here.
man.
So they say examples of that include a non-invasive spinal tap equivalent.
Oh my God. I can't believe you just said non-invasive spinal tap. That's incredible. How are we even pretending this makes sense?
I don't know, but this is what these are their words.
Yeah, I know. I'm just laughing at you. Ridiculous. Yeah.
Anyway, and single session neural monitoring capabilities that define a treatment predictive brain state and stuff like that.
So what would be invasive? If a spinal tap is not invasive, I mean, for crying out loud. Like
no, they want to make a non-invasive version of a spinal tap that does the same thing and can tap into your heart.
Ah, okay. That makes more sense. I was like, good God, that's just ridiculous. It's like brain, non-invasive brain surgery. Weird. Go ahead.
yeah. Anyway, so those are basically the programs in a nutshell. And so I conclude with some of these quotes about the Wellcome Trust and also from Julian Huxley. So the Wellcome Trust was actually the subject of this 1994 investigation, now scrubbed from the Sunday Times in the UK. Hmm. But there it talks about, and this is 1994, decades ago. It says, through Wellcome Trust grants and sponsorships, government agencies, universities, hospitals, and scientists are influenced all over the world. The trust distributes more money to institutions than even the British government's Medical Research Council. But here's the most important quote, I think, from that. In offices on the buildings, meaning the Wellcome Trust buildings, first floor, decisions are reached that affect lives and health on scales comparable with minor wars.
Wow.
In the conference room, high above the street, and in the meeting hall, in the basement, rulings in biotechnology and genetics are handed down that will shape the human race.
There it is. Right in an open quote.
1994.
Right. Exactly. It's just so crazy the way that they're, not only is there constantly this crossover with the war analogy, right? The way you frame this is so exactly spot on. Your body is now the war, is now the battlefield, as you put it. That's exactly what they're talking about, right? I mean, it's all war compare even today with the war on COVID-19. And as you said, the shape, the human race, this is the evolution, the nanotechnology, the technocracy, the transhumanism.
It's exactly. Right. And so I point out there that this is like not a little endeavor that we can ignore. Wellcome Leap. You know, this is arguably a foundation just as, if not more powerful than Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, teaming up with the kings and queens of public-private partnerships of this Orwellian surveillance technology from DARPA to Silicon Valley, with the guy that dominates the entire gene sequencing industry. All coming together to do this to the world. No thanks. Let's pay attention to these guys.
All right. Aiming directly at your children, too, in the process.
Directly at babies, dude.
Man. Yeah, it's just, there's no better word than sinister. I mean, it doesn't matter whether they think this is for some greater good. That's what I always point out. It doesn't matter. Like, if you think that destroying half the population is going to benefit the other half, it doesn't make that some noble agenda. You're still murdering people, right? So it's whether they've convinced themselves it's for the right thing. And I state again, I don't think that's the case. I just don't. But whether or not, this is sinister. What they're doing is changing your world without your acknowledgement, without even knowing it's happening. It's just so crazy. But by the way, it's the same thing that happened with 9/11 and everything before it. I think right now, because of work like yours, Whitney, people are just more attuned to it. They're seeing it. And I think that speaks to the ham-fisted, rushed nature of all this because people are seeing it. That's my opinion.
Yeah, but they're counting on people not seeing this stuff and being distracted by a lot of other things. And what I think is interesting is I'm sure everyone's noticed that a lot of stuff that people like you and me and a lot of other people in independent media with actual integrity were covering last year. Like possibilities of a lab origin, now that's okay. Or early treatments of COVID being suppressed so that the only possible treatment was the vaccine. All of that is now coming out to the front. But what I really want to stress is I think a lot of people that are trying to take control of this narrative now and push it out into the mainstream or limited hangouts, they're getting big. They're going on not all of them, obviously, but some of them are going on the big channels and introducing information that's been known for a long time. To people that have been following this and acting like they're the people that have discovered this so that people, those audiences will be like, wow, this guy, and then everything they say afterward, they'll trust.
And then right,
for the next big thing
in the wrong direction.
Yeah, I definitely think Brett Weinstein is in that category. I'm not going to go into some of the other ones, but the Weinstein brothers, I think, are very sus, specifically Eric Weinstein, who works for Peter Thiel, who is building all of this stuff.
Well, it speaks to the nature of why we should question everything, right? It doesn't mean like Robert Malone, the inventor of mRNA vaccine technology, who was on that podcast. You know, there's a lot of information that was put out there that seems very relevant and I still find very, very important.
Right. I'm not disagreeing with that,
Let me finish my point. What I was going to say was but it's still important to question whether or not that could be a means to an end to manipulate, right? I mean, it doesn't matter. We should, that same thing with this show right now. You shouldn't be blindly trusting it because we're saying it, right? You should be questioning it or the possibility that we could just be wrong or that they could just be wrong. I just think it's an important point that you stated there is that, you know, there's reasons to be questioning any, even people that are saying what you think is on point, right?
Yeah. Well, I think the excuse that people give for these guys is like, well, it doesn't matter because they're getting the content out to a bigger audience. And while that's true, what happens when they start feeding in CIA talking points to the audience that now trusts them? That's what we have to be worried about.
Couldn't agree more. Okay. And that's why you shouldn't trust. You shouldn't have that blind faith for any output. You should always show you discernment.
So another example I want to bring up, please go back and read part 3 of the Engineering Contagion series about Robert Kadlec. Right. One of the people rebranding as these guys is actually Stephen Hatfill, who was the first person investigated by the FBI for anthrax attack ties. He didn't do it, but his mentor, in my opinion, definitely did. And Hatfield could have been involved. And now he's sort of rebranding as one of these guys saying, oh, the suppression of early treatments, blah, blah, blah. But he has longstanding ties with the CIA and contractors, and the anthrax attack stuff is so shady. And the reason he was flagged is because his mentor obviously freaking did it. And you can see in that article, I won't go into it too much, but I wouldn't trust Hatfield that much, even if the information he's saying, and just because of how contentious this stuff is and how the people in power know that this narrative is falling apart for them. They need sophisticated assets in this independent media sphere to take it away from people with actual integrity and people that will get the attention, say the right stuff to get people to trust them, and then start being the new MSM or the new Rachel Maddows for all the people that are like saying, I'm not going to watch mainstream media anymore.
Okay. I couldn't agree more. And I recommend everybody read this series that she wrote because it's fantastic. But it's a good example is, say, whoever's reporting it, somebody in the mainstream coming out and saying, oh, the lab leak theory is now something we should consider.
Yeah.
But
so some of these
only comes out in the context of China bad guy, no U.S. involvement.
Yeah.
So yes, they're saying something we should at least consider. Not that I think that's necessarily the focal point, but it's a limited hangout, as you pointed out.
Yeah, I'm just saying we have to be really vigilant about this stuff because this is obvious some sort of space that they're trying to dominate now.
Totally.
I think we have to be really wary of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think my point is just simply that's how they process that. They will give you something that seems and is even actually something you should consider, but they then immediately lead you into a corner where you're not getting all the information, and then they segue into other, like, that's your point. And I think that is happening a lot.
So, right, you know, if the people that are talking about this now weren't talking about this or refused to engage with this stuff last year, I think that should be a red flag.
Yes.
One person that's been getting a lot of play in mainstream media who I actually think is very legit is Peter McCullough, who's been on Fox News a lot, but he spent all of last year developing a lot of those early treatment protocols and was very involved in that and vocal about that then. And, you know, now that it's okay to talk about it, he's getting more screen time, right? But he's been consistent in that view. You know,
Taylor actually has an interview she did with him about a couple of weeks ago that she's editing. So that'll be coming out soon. But yeah, I agree. You know, just because someone goes on Fox or mainstream doesn't necessarily mean that they're compromised.
But what I'm saying is, you know, the Weinstein brothers specifically, I don't trust them at all. I think intellectual web in general has a lot of shady stuff to it. It tends to promote a lot of people associated directly with Peter Thiel, who's not a libertarian, a dangerous authoritarian, whose company, like Palantir and his other companies, including Thiel Capital, where Eric Weinstein is a managing director, are investing directly in brain machine interfaces, or Peter Thiel's startup to like harvest the blood of young people to stop aging and all of this stuff. Right. I mean, and Palantir is literally like the all-seeing eye. That's the New York Times way of framing it, by the way, of the coming panopticon. Yeah, are we going to trust people that work for that dude and are like, I'm fine working for this dude, but I want you to trust me about what's going on in the world? Nah,
But again, that's the point. don't trust any of them, but listen to all of them, right? It's not, that's the fallacy there is that we shouldn't choose to trust one or the other. We have to be open to all of them and listen to that podcast and know that they're funded by this. And if you have information you walk away with that's important, then do so. But cross-reference that with other sources, like like myself, you know what I mean? That's how the picture has to go, because I try to steer away from the concern. Like for instance, when that Van der Bosch guy came out, there was this weird kind of schism that happened in the community where it was like, you know, Del Bigtree talked about this and people are going, well, now Del Bigtree's compromised. And I'm like, wait a minute, guys. We just have to realize that even if this Bosch guy is compromised, there's information he did discuss that's valid to point out, but we have to be skeptical, right? That's the overarching point, you know? And I think this is a good place since we're about two and a half hours. Go ahead. You can add points to that, but just.
I'll just really quick. And then I just want to end with the quote at the end of the piece.
Hopefully
I can have my secretary make clips out of this. If you don't.
No, I'm definitely going to have Brock clip this up. For sure. I'll ask him to anyway.
So basically what we have to be vigilant about is not necessarily the information they're putting out now, because a lot of it is pretty good. Right. But like I said, it's when down the line a big event happens and they'll be there to set the narrative on it, because people don't trust mainstream media anymore, but they're going to trust these guys.
All right. Just don't trust any of them.
And the Weinstein brothers are that for the right, I think, for more like, you know, not necessarily the MAGA sphere, but more like rational right leaning people. I definitely think there are outlets like that for the progressive left as well. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to name them, but I think people can think a little bit about it and figure out who they are. So I think this is very sophisticated. And I think we have to be really vigilant. As we mentioned earlier about the domestic terror thing, there's a very high possibility of some sort of event to ram that through. What will these people say on it? You know?
Right.
And the key thing is to see if they've had integrity this whole time, or if they're just starting to talk about this stuff now when it's safe. And if they're doing it in such a way that's a limited hangout, I think that's really important.
I'll give you my prediction right now. I can promise you, in my opinion, I just promise you that's kind of a contradiction, but I can tell you that in my opinion that these the people that will come out after something happens and demonize the scapegoat. Like, let's say there's an anti-vaxxer attack on it, whatever. And it's like, these people should be charged, and anyone saying they're good should be censored. They're going to be, that's them, right? That the people that will jump on that side of it, maybe they just argue that the vaccine program should stop, but now suddenly they're telling you this guy's a criminal and, blah, blah, blah. That's going to be the inside, right? That's going to be the red flag.
Mm-hmm. But I think one of the key ways, I think one of the key ways to suss out these people on the left and the right. And there are also people like my old nemesis, Glenn Greenwald, who I think are trying to bridge both worlds of these plants on the right and the left. They vilify 9/11 truth. They're like, 9/11 truth is crazy and I'll never talk about it.
Which is a big
That should be a big red flag to people. Like, you can't talk about it after 20 years.
Right. That's the litmus test. He said that is the litmus test for a truther, that if, where you stand on the general, not the details.
Yeah, but are you going to trust these people on the next false flag or on the next intervention, when a lot of these outlets were wrong for years and years and years about things like Syria and stuff like that?
Right. Exactly.
Why don't you trust the outlets that were right on it from the beginning? Same with COVID.
Again, don't trust any of us. Question everything. That's important. I know I get your point, but I just want to make sure the verbiage is correct, because even if people are going, okay, well then we'll trust you, in my opinion, that's just as problematic.
Everyone makes mistakes. I'm not disagreeing with that, but I'm just saying, like, at least, I know, like, the reason when I wanted to work with you last year is because I knew that you had integrity. We're not going to be right 100% of the time, but there's a limited number of people in this space that are in this for the right reasons. Mm-hmm. Right. And they tend to be more right about the stuff than the other people. That's basically what I was getting at, you're totally right. It's important to scrutinize everything. I definitely agree with that. So anyway, in the interest of time, I'm just going to go through that last quote. So this is actually from John Klesik, who did a really great article, also long article, for Unlimited Hangout, a few weeks ago on the education system in UNESCO. But basically, he talks about this, how Julian Huxley, we talked about this in the beginning, in his 1957 book, New Bottles for New Wine, says, quote, the eugenic goals of biologically engineering human evolution should be refined through transhumanist technologies, which combine the eugenic methods of genetic engineering with neurotech that merges humans and machines into a new organism. Okay. We are at the end game of that here right now. And this is from the 50s. A dude that was an overt racist eugenicist. And I just want to point out the Eugenics Society was very powerful. Its members were people like Winston Churchill. We're like card-carrying, proud members of this thing.
And these are people, people that are lionized today, right? Like, as you know, and they're leaders of this.
Yeah, this was an elite institution, and it still is, but it's gone more covert. They're now the Galton Institute, right? But their academics are still at prominent elite academic institutions. This is still very much going on, and really, you know, this is some in-game stuff. My last paragraph here. You know, I say, you know, will we allow ourselves to continue to be manipulated into allowing transhumanism and eugenics to be openly pursued and normalized, including through initiatives like those of Welcome Leap that seek to use babies and toddlers as test subjects? If a well-crafted advertising slogans and media campaigns painting visions of utopia like a world without disease are all that is needed to convince us to give up our future and our children's future to military operatives, corporate executives, and eugenicists, there is little left of our humanity to surrender. And I really think that is super true.
I agree.
You know, I think plenty of us still have fight in us and don't want to see humanity eliminated. So I would hope that people, you know, take that as a call to action and go out and contact some of these people. Go through the Welcome Leap website. They all have lead researchers. They're going to be giving awards away to different universities. They have a global network of different universities and institutions. They can all be contacted. They all have email addresses. They all have office numbers. Tell them what you think.
Yeah. I just can't stress enough how clearly this is something that is counter to the very interest of the American people of the human race. And it's obvious that the claim that this is leading to the extinction of the human race, I can't stress enough that that is not hyperbole. This is literally what is being driven toward and what they're actually stating in multiple documents. And what Whitney's talked about, what James has talked about, what we've talked about, we have to recognize what a real threat this is. And that's not because we disagree with the agenda, but because this is counter to the very interest of the species. And that's a very crazy, I mean, and again, the crossover between COVID-19 to the war on domestic terror and all the different moving parts that are driving this in the very same direction. And I just can't thank you enough for doing the work that you're doing, Whitney. And this is important stuff. So thank you.
Thanks. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, just to drive this home, I mean, basically they are telling you that the only way to be healthy is to be a transhumanist slave.
Right.
That's nuts. And I think we'll see more of that going forward, that, you know, the immune system is a thing of the past. Health as we knew it before, a thing of the past. They're redefining all of the stuff to make you think that transhumanism and eugenics healthcare. That's what's going on right now. And we have to call it out. We have to expose it to people and we have to stop it. I think a majority of Americans, regardless if they've been brainwashed by left MSM or right MSM or whatever, you show this to them and you're like, is this healthcare to you? Do you want this to be the only healthcare available to you? They'll be like, no. But what I think the Biden administration will do will be like, oh, you want Medicare for all? Well, you can have free healthcare. That's this. And it's the transhumanist eugenicist stuff and people will eat it up. But people need to realize what's really going on. The last thing progressives should support is an open eugenics agenda.
Well, wouldn't that be telling that the Medicare for all led right into the lion's mouth, right? I mean, whatever the expression is, you know what I mean? That would explain quite a lot. But yeah, it's a great
one. Socialists are terrorists and Medicare for all is going to become eugenics. Just wait.
Yeah, and you know what? It's people clip that right there. I'm sure that will become relevant down the line. But, you know, thank you for Whitney again for being here. And I think this is just important stuff. So please heed her words. Pay attention. Thank you all for being here. I love you all. As always, question everything. Come to your own conclusions. Stay vigilant.
Today,
wrong one.
This nation geographically is completed. There are no new frontiers within our borders. So, to what new horizons can we look now? Where are tomorrow's opportunities? What's ahead for you, for your children? The frontiers of the future are not on any map. They are in the test tubes and laboratories of the great industries.
The Jacobardi case was one of the great judicial moments in world history, and the public was totally unaware it was actually happening as the process was being engaged. General Electric and Professor Jacobardi went to the patent office with a little microbe that eats up oil spills. They said they had modified this microbe in the laboratory, and therefore it was an invention. The patent office, the U.S. government, took a look at this, quote, invention, and they said, no way. The patent statutes don't cover living things. This is not an invention. Turned down. Then General Electric and Dr. Jacobardi appealed to the U.S. Customs Court of Appeal. And to everyone's surprise, by a 3-2 decision, they overrode the patent office. We bring good things to life. And they said, this microbe looks more like a detergent or a reagent than a horse or a honeybee. I laugh because they didn't understand basic biology. It looked like a chemical to them. Had it had an antenna or eyes or wings or legs, it would never have crossed their table and been patented. Then the patent office appealed. And what the public should realize now is the patent office was very clear that you can't patent life. My organization provided the main amicus curiae brief. If you allow the patent on this microbe, we argued, it means that without any congressional guidance or public discussion, corporations will own the blueprints of life. When they made the decision, we lost by 5-4, and Chief Justice Warren Burger said, sure, some of these are big issues, but we think this is a small decision. 7 years later, the U.S. Patent Office issued a one-sentence decree. You can patent anything in the world that's alive except a full-birth human being.